HBO! This is another episode of the Gaming Memories Podcast, where I, Kate Call, your host, the one true gaming prophet of the one true gaming gospel, he who hath been anointed by the gaming gods themselves, even Miyamoto, the father, Kojima, the son, and Carmack, the Holy Ghost, was commissioned by these gaming gods to create the one true video game podcast simply by interviewing creative and interesting people about their favorite gaming memories growing up. And today we're going to be kind of doing that. Today's guest is Chase Henson. He is a very talented artist. Already been on the podcast once before, so if you want to hear about his gaming memories specifically, you're going to have to go back to number yada yada yada. I don't remember. Google it. Look it up. It's going to be easy shit to find. It's a good episode. He's a little bit of a Nintendo kid, but, you know, we'll forgive him for that. He's on the podcast today to talk more about what he's been gaming and also to promote his new Kickstarter. All the links to that Kickstarter will be in the podcast description. We discussed it in length in the episode, so there's really no reason to talk about it here. All thing I'm going to say in the intro is it's dope as shit. So please check his Kickstarter out. Support it if you feel so inclined. We chat about aliens, ancient civilizations, politics, and even, surprisingly enough, we actually talk about video games a little bit. So anyway, you know, some episodes are video game heavy, some episodes are not. This is a little bit of a mix. Chase is a fantastic human being. Again, please, his Kickstarter is dope. The book is going to be dope. His art is dope. He likes dope video games, minus he's a huge fan of Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom, which I get. Most of the world seems to be big fans of those games. I'm just not one of them, so maybe we should be forgiving me. Ah, I'm a gaming prophet. I can't. I'm infallible, so fuck you guys. Those games suck. Still love you, Chase. Please check his shit out. Remember to share the good news of the gaming gospel. I say these things in the name of me, Immortal Father, Kojima the Son, and Carmack, the Holy Ghost. Amen, and enjoy the show. All right, we're live. Dude, we're going to give a little background to who you are for those who haven't listened, but I think a lot of people have because you, for a long time, held the highest record for downloads on the podcast. I think like a good year and a half, 2 years, you were the good. Most downloaded episode. How long has it been since you were on?
Oh, man, 2018, 2019?
It's been a hot minute.
It was way before the pandy because we weren't even... Wasn't even brought up. It hadn't been 2018. It's been a minute.
Have I been doing the podcast that long? 2018?
Or 2019? Because I know I was still living in my house in Provo.
So you were early, because the podcast
started
taking off during COVID, because that's when I started getting drunk and making social media videos. Are you still doing Moam Wrath, the band?
Yeah. Yeah, so during the pandemic, definitely took a hard nosedive. We played probably one show in a year and a half for obvious reasons. Couldn't even be in a venue. Yeah. Our first show back was at the loading dock after they moved out of the actual loading dock venue. Did you ever go to that place?
I've seen flyers for it, but I never went.
It's literally a hallway, like a literal cement loading dock.
Oh, wait, no. Didn't I go to one of your shows before Moam Wrath, a band that was, before that?
Yeah, you went to the very first one of that. That band was called And the Winner Is.
Was that the loading dock? That venue?
No. Oh, no, okay. that was Oz Pool Hall or something.
Yeah, it was Oz. Yeah.
Our first show was back at the loading dock 2021 at the end of the year. I'm trying to think when we played before that. We played at the Ice House December of 2019, and then the pandemic hit 3 months later, and then, you know, nothing. Everything was online back then. Everybody's freaking out about staying home, and they were like, you got to stay in place at your house. And every artist that I knew was like, oh, we have to stay home for a week. That's our favorite thing to do. We're the most introverted community ever. Like, that was so easy for us. 2 weeks of like, I played Fire Emblem.
Okay, which one?
It was Engage? No, that's the new one. It was Three Houses.
Three Houses. Yeah.
Yeah. Shit, that game was so fun. I think I, for a solid week, played 8 hours a day. That was right during the lockdown, so I bought it for that. Played a full week of it, just nonstop. Beat the game. I don't know if I played any other games, but that was like my pandemic game. And God, that game was so fun.
It's on my list. It's on my list to play.
It's super fun. The new one that just came out, I believe it's called Engage. It was apparently a kind of a flop. If you look at the concept art for it, it was just like, it was so bad.
I thought Three Houses was the new one. I didn't even realize there's a new one out.
No.
I haven't seen any marketing for it.
Yeah, and it just looks like they have that fucking Pepsi Cola hair design, that red and the blue, and it's just like, I had a friend who played it, and he said it was terrible, but Three Houses was definitely the better version of that. Super fun. I'd never played a turn-based top-down strategy like that, where you're actually moving across the battlefield instead of like turn-based battle, where you're just one location. This was super cool because it added that extra dimension of moving your characters around. It was like chess. It was fucking so fun. Good concept art, great music, very anime. You know, I'm super into anime, so that's not a problem for me, but
it's blown my mind how anime keeps getting more mainstream here.
Oh yeah.
I keep thinking we've reached anime culture has peaked in the US and then it continues to grow. I'm like, all right, how far is this going to go?
Yeah. It's going to be mainstream, dude. Like we talk about Demon Slayer, that's the most recent, Attack on Titan. They became very popular, and then My Hero Academia. And once they started putting the big ones on Netflix and people were like trying them out and realizing that the stories were incredible and unique and original concepts, and it's just like you can do things with anime that you can't do in any other medium. You can do the craziest fight scenes, and when you mix a little bit of 3D animation into there, it's like
I like realize the 3D. That it's sick. A lot of hardcore anime heads, like some of my friends that have been on the podcast as well, have had a hard time getting into either the full 3D or the partial 3D ones. But do you remember one that was on? It was a Netflix original called Knights of Sidonia.
Yeah.
Knights of Sidonia season one was fucking baller. They dropped the ball on season two, but
yeah,
that was the first fully 3D anime where I'm like, okay, I can do full 3D anime. It can be done.
Yep. Yeah. Most of them, from what I've seen, haven't been good. The best ones that I've seen are Knights of Sidonia, and then Demon Slayer is really doing a killer job mixing both. They're not just doing one or the other. They're doing both. Probably because they're a big animation studio and they can afford it, you know. And then Sword Art Online, of course, had some 3D stuff that they did a really good job in. And anime's super mainstream. You see it at Comic Cons when I'm selling stuff there. There's animes everywhere, dude. And people in Utah already live kind of in their own fantasy world, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's not too far of a stretch for their imagination to believe in like the super nerdy shit that's around here.
What's your favorite? Because you mentioned something that anime has a lot of unique concepts as far as like setups or foundations for narratives. And I 100% agree. What do you think is the most unique or cool, not like minute to minute writing, voice acting story, but like foundation lore concept in an anime?
Oh, man. There's so many strong opinions on the best anime. Fans tend to be very one-sided when it comes to their favorite anime, but dude, Attack on Titan, I don't know if you've ever seen or you know the concept, but
yeah,
the story is insane. And it just the creature design and how weird they make you feel, and then like the setting and set, like the clothing design is kind of like old world medieval style, but they've got futuristic like steam powered weapons, and then they've got cannons, so they kind of live in the Civil War era, but they're clothing design is a little farther back. Japanese culture tends to take clothing design to the max. When you watch any video game or movie that they make, they're so good at conceptualizing new monsters and new ideas, and it's just insanity.
I like that you brought that one up. I've been really into esoteric, like secret societies, fraternal orders, hidden mystery schools, the occult versions of every mainstream religion. So like Christians have the Gnostics, the Jews have the Kabbalah, so on and so forth. Theosophy is this philosophy that kind of combines them all. And there's a lot of esoteric symbolism and ideas in Attack on Titan. And so I was looking into what inspirations they drew from to brainstorm that world and that series. They also, this is interesting, I don't know if they believe it, but they pulled from Flat Earth lore, because the Flat Earth,
what?
There's lots of different variations of Flat Earth, and I'm into fringe shit. I'm not claiming I'm a Flat Earther, but I like listening to what the crazy fringe people have to say, because speaking of growing up in Utah, I was told a certain fringe group of people were all full of shit and there's no reason to listen to them and it's all lies. And it turned out it wasn't all lies. They were telling the truth. That was the real history. So I've always been like, okay, you know, if someone says, don't listen to this group or that group, they're all full of shit, I'm like, they might be, but I'll decide if they're full of shit.
Right, right, right.
What I found is the Flat Earth world is like deeply splintered on what they actually believe. There is not a lot of consistency.
Wow.
But there is a few common themes. A lot of them believe that whether the shape of the Earth is less important, the most common theme is that there is more Earth than we've been told.
Oh.
And it's been hidden. And the idea of the ice wall is the wall, the city walls in Attack on Titan, that first main city. You know how they have like the rings of the walls? And then there's like the uninhabited big world out there, the mystery. We don't know where the, you know, obviously you find out later. I don't want to spoil this for anyone who hasn't watched the show, but you right. find out where the giants come from. There's actually civilizations outside and history outside of the wall. And that idea came from the idea of the ice wall, and that there's continents wow. beyond the ice wall, and there's hidden technology. And you get into the government and the religion inside the wall, where yeah. Eren and they come up as the Titan killers. Pulled that all, and then back to the 1800s type clothing. Admiral Byrd is like one of the most famous explorers that flat earthers will quote, and he claims before they did that the treaty in Antarctica, where like you can't go to the North and South Pole. You can go to a little bit, but the rest, you know, there's this international treaty. It's probably for oil or some other shit, but you can't go. And Admiral Byrd is one of the last people in recorded history that went beyond the, like, I think it's the 69th parallel or something. And he claims there was like a whole other continent full of people, whatever. So I'm not saying that's the truth, but what I learned that's is nuts. They drew from that lore and that idea to kind of come up with this idea of what the world is in Attack on Titan.
That's crazy. Yeah. That's as you're telling me this storyline of this adventure, it plays into Eren's story so well, what he discovers, like, he kind of represents the viewer as we're going through this story and discovering the history. And
yes,
you see his transformation, even in his drawing. The early seasons, he's very young and doe-eyed and just ready to go and fight. And because he lost his, well, maybe I shouldn't give away any spoilers, but his storyline is, you see how ragged he gets towards the end.
Yes.
And he's a totally different person, and he becomes something you never expected.
And he discovers the great lie. Right. Of the civilization and the organization he's a part of. And that's the right. idea, is that even among the disagreements of flat earthers, they all believe that basically when the Rockefellers came in and the Federal Reserve was created, and they handed everything over to the banking system, and then that turned in and created the Board of Education, they believe that like all that history was buried. It was kind of like a modern day burning of the Library of Alexandria.
Yeah.
Where they just sort of phased out all this stuff. There's a guy on YouTube called The Archivist that he goes through state by state, and he pulls up all the photocopies that he can find of any old newspaper articles. The farthest back you can get is like the early 1800s, and then he goes up to maybe the early 1900s. And he just aggregates all the weird anomalous reports he finds in newspaper clippings from the early 1800s.
Crazy.
Anyway, it's very interesting. I don't know if I buy like the whole everything is a lie, but that concept resonates with me, because obviously growing up Mormon, my whole paradigm was a lie. And then when I found that out, I had a – and it's like Eren goes right. on a similar journey, where he finds out his whole civilization, religion, government, the view of the world he was taught, and why there's the walls and why there's the Titans. He finds out the truth behind all of that. It's like the same hero's journey, kind of.
Yeah, that's super interesting. There's a guy named Carl Randerson or something.
Oh, Randall Carlson?
Randall Carlson. I was mixing his name up.
He's the shit.
When his talks about an ancient civilization pre Ice Age, that we lost a bunch of knowledge and an entire race of people, and that we're behind them technologically or different versions of technology, is so fascinating to think back that far back into humanity's existence, right? The story of the six sages is kind of a repeating story you see in mythology, which a lot of my artwork is based on. So it kind of drew me into that like path of ancient civilizations and the tracing of the monomyth. But these six sages are potentially, you see them in all the different mythologies, but they're potentially the six men who carried that old knowledge and shared it with different villages and was traveling around. And there were supposedly these traveling magicians that would give these small villages this random technology or things that they held on to. So there's things
that had survived the cataclysm. Yeah.
Right. So that's super fascinating because a lot of these mythologies are thousands of years apart or tens of thousands of miles or hundreds of thousands, like no way that they could have been in contact, but they all have very similar repeating stories and, you know, flood myths and the six sages, and everybody's got kind of their own creation story. But
yes, I think Randall Carlson's idea of an asteroid impact being the primary catalyst, right, for a cataclysm would cause great floods all over the world.
100%.
So I can see where, you know, obviously there's the flood myth in the Bible, but that's not the only place that a flood myth pops up. It's all over the place.
It's in every mythology.
Yes. I think him and Graham Hancock are a team and Graham Hancock's been preaching the same thing, that there's civilization. And I think that's what the flat earth, they're getting onto, that there's things that we've lost. Now, that they may argue about the details. This archivist guy thinks that there was a smaller cataclysm in Southwest America, some sort of plasma event. And a plasma can be created through an impact, the extreme heat. And they think that there was a smaller cataclysm in the Americas in like the late 1700s, where we lost some stuff. And that there's probably been, the one that Randall Carlson's talking about was like a global cataclysm. They theorized that there could have been less than 100,000 people left after that cataclysm. I mean, it brought down the population to almost nothing. And they keep finding, the other day I saw that they found not a anatomically modern human, but a Neanderthal. It's not Homo. There's the Neanderthals, and then there was another almost human that lived alongside humans. I forget the name. I'm going to forget the scientific name. It's like Homo something, 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 erectus, or I can't remember. They think that they...
Homo habilis?
Maybe. They found a burial ground and a tomb and evidence that they had some sort of burial practice. So the idea is that, like, okay, we found anatomically modern humans that go back 400,000 years, but the idea is that there was no civilization. They're just cavemen, hunter-gatherers.
Right. Right?
They're basically almost monkeys.
Yeah.
But then they're finding burial grounds where they obviously had like some sort of tradition and they're burying their dead. That's indicative of some type of civilization.
Right. Of a higher.
And they're also running LIDAR in the Amazon, and they're like finding shit four or five layers.
I love that.
And then like there's like aqueducts and highways, and like, okay. I think the mainstream academic consensus is slowly opening up to the idea that civilization might be older than we originally thought. And I think if that opens up and we realize, okay, and cataclysm can kill some of our history, what if there's also been other smaller local cataclysms that kill local history for a certain group of people? And that's the idea, that maybe there's history in the Americas as recent as the 1800s that we've lost. I thought about this a lot. History has got to be one of the most difficult sciences of all time, because it is inherently a very soft science. Because where do you learn history from? From someone who wrote something down. Well, who writes stuff down? A human being. It's not measurements of data like carbon dating or radio waves, right? It's not measured by an instrument. It's subjectively measured by a human being based on their perception, and then they write it down. And the farther back you go, usually you have a bigger gap between the event and then when somebody wrote it down. And if we were to have this conversation, and then tomorrow you and I recapped this conversation just the day after, and then we compared our notes, we're going to have very different notes.
Right.
And so history, like, inherently has bad data. Like, the best data is still subjective. and the best data is 1%. And the other 99% of the data is even more subjective because there might be a gap of 100 years between the event and then the oldest record of some historian guy that maybe heard this story passed down orally, then he finally wrote it down, or she finally wrote it down 100 years later. And it's like, to think that we've got it all figured out is really like almost, what's the word? Not haughty, but like presumptuous.
Mm.
And then the farther back you go, like, let's say there was a civilization that existed 5 million years ago. Would there be anything left?
Right.
There's nothing left. So even if we find some buried burial ground that's 1 million years old, that doesn't mean civilization went back 1 million years. It means the oldest thing we've ever found is 1 million years ago. But if there was a civilization 10 million years ago, there would be no evidence. We would never find anything. So I don't think we can ever actually answer the question how far back civilization goes, because there's the farther back you go, the less likelihood there's going to be anything left.
Right. Yeah. And hearing that on first thought, you might lose trust in science or in human accuracy. But that kind of gives me comfort knowing that right now, based on what we currently know, this is what we understand of the world. But if we find some new shit, we're going to change it.
It's like this mix of, I get frustrated. Like, you have dogmatic set ideas. Like, I know Randall Carlson and Graham Hancock have been talking about, hey, maybe there's a cataclysm, maybe there's civilization older. And they were mocked and laughed out of town for 20 years. And then now the evidence is piling up. They're being vindicated. But it kind of has to work like that, because I love exploring the fringe, because the breakthroughs come from the fringe, but it's like a slot machine. Most of the fringe stuff really is crazy fucking people out there. But every once in a while, some of them are right. And so you need this process of like, okay, we're not going to change our academic consensus based on like one guy's idea. But if that one guy's idea accumulates evidence over the next 20 years, we'll be forced kicking and screaming, unfortunately, in some cases, because people's egos are involved. But eventually the system does update itself when there's enough evidence that it can't be denied anymore. And then we'll say, okay, we're officially changing the consensus model of history, because now we've gotten enough evidence that we can't ignore it anymore.
Right. But at least it changes. You know, we grew up in a culture that is stuck in a single ideology about how the world is made, about how humans interact with each other, about everything. And that never changes. And we see that when they try to pass policies in the church or allow people to have 3 earrings instead of 1, you know what I mean? It's like, they just can't accept gay people. They refuse to change. And they're slowly like letting little farts out. And they're like, here's a little one for you guys. We'll just let you do this. 17-year-old women can go on missions now. Don't you like that? But science is like, yeah, this is what we know. Some people are going to throw a fit because their whole careers are based around, you know, a certain path in history or whatever. They, you know, they write books and they build all of that. But at least it changes a little bit. And that always gives me a little hope. And I love that there's still shit that we don't know about our history and about ancient civilizations. And we get close to getting into the like UFOs and ancient civilizations and, you know, all the weird conspiracy type stuff. But there's so much mystery. How do you not get wrapped up in that super fast? And then especially with like the UFO stuff coming out that's recently confirmed about having 12 or more spacecraft or tic-tac vehicles
I think we've talked about that. I've been on the UFO thing for a decade, and
I love it, dude.
Been mocked by everyone left and right, really good friends and family. You're just a pothead. But the evidence was there if you went into it. Like, the evidence was there. I'm really deep into the UFO world. I follow, like, I'm not an actual researcher, but I'm someone who researches. I'm like one tier below. I keep up with all the people who are doing the work and what's going on. And I'm listening to probably like 10 to 15 hours of podcasts a week, keeping up with what's going on. We've known this, like, the community has known this was coming, that the term non-human intelligence was going to be used, because the word alien has so much baggage. I see why they don't want to use it. And the truth is it might be more complicated than just some biological being from another planet. I mean, really, really respected people from MIT, Stanford, Jacques Vallée, Eric Davis, Gary Nolan, these people are saying this phenomenon might be like dimensional and energy. And they use the term energy because the word spiritual has some baggage to it. But yeah. Energy and spiritual are synonymous in my mind. They're just different ways to sort of describe the same phenomena. And since 2017, the New York Times article came out and they revealed that ATIP was a real program, which was a subset of OSAP, which was a subset of MKUltra, which is a big program that they looked into all sorts of weird anomalous stuff. There's been this disclosure movement, and I heard like probably like 4 months ago that hardcore disclosure was coming. And I'm like, yeah, they always say that's years away. And then just this week, that debrief article comes out and it's like 75% of official disclosure. And they just flat out, we have craft. And they say the words from non-human sources.
Yeah.
And it's like, holy, and nobody gives a fuck, really. Like the grand scheme, nobody gives a fuck. And I'm sitting here like, this is the biggest story ever. And it dovetails into like we were talking about. I do think there are conspiracies where certain things are hidden. But I also, like I was saying, I think history is such a difficult discipline because, again, the inherent nature of the data is so low quality. It's the farther back you go, it's basically an impossible task to pin down what happened.
Right.
You know, once you get past like once you get pre-printing press, I mean, it's really, really hard. You're working with such little data sources. All of them are subjective. It's basically an impossible task. And I don't think you necessarily need some grand consensus among like the institute or grand conspiracy amongst the institutions to hide stuff. Or it could just be, this is an impossible task. And the best we can do is this. And we got a lot of shit wrong because this is an impossible task.
Yeah, I don't think you could have predicted how to record your current history, your current timeline back in the day, right? People were writing things down, but as villages got raided or libraries got burned, like a random scroll that some fucking king told some other guy to write some shit down and he maybe forgot some words and like, yeah, the king did this on like fucking Tuesday and then that shit got burned down and you're like, oh, we don't really remember what the king did. So kind of do like a brief summary and we'll write it down. And then that gets stored into a facility and put into a book and then retranslated a bunch of times, similar to a very famous book called The Bible that has been retranslated 13 plus times in different languages and rewritten by people taking over and just, you know, just buried in blood.
Injecting their own beliefs into it and massaging the, you know, and taking out certain things that contradicted their beliefs and putting in. And one thing I learned recently is I always thought that the Bible is basically compiled at the Nicene Creed, but that was just the first of many sort of executive meetings that it took. And that the Bible started out, even the Roman Catholic Bible started out with something like 80 plus books. And then eventually over time, they whittled it down to the 60 some odd books that we have right now. Hmm. And that process took multiple generations. It wasn't just like a one and done. And that's what I thought. Cause I think the Nicene Creed, I forget, it was like anywhere between 75 to 150, maybe even up to 300 years. I haven't brushed up on the history, so don't quote me on any numbers. But there was a significant gap between the death of Jesus and then the oldest writings, and then even a bigger gap between when those writings first started getting compiled in any sort of official, this is the book, this is the canon. And then once that compiling process also went through different iterations and phases. Then you tack on the translation process over the years.
Right.
And it's like, okay, no wonder nobody can agree on what the Bible means because there is no single coherent message. It all got, if there ever was one to begin with, it all got lost in time.
Yeah. Well, it's all fan fiction written by AI, right? It's just, everybody has their own version of it. Everybody's added things. They've changed things. They've got different forms of Christianity, and that's cool if you want to like make your own little Christian clique and start a new religion, but it's really hard to believe something that's been rewritten and retranslated. And don't even get me started on the Book of Mormon. Like, that thing is, I got a lot of family that's Mormon, so I maybe it's too late, I don't want to offend them, but I can't imagine there's a lot of objective truths in that.
It might have inherited some because Joseph Smith was pulling and like all artists, right? They're kind of remixing different influences they have in their life and then filtering it through the lens of their own personal experience. And then out comes some sort of quote, original art. But that art is built from the art and ideas of previous humans that, and it funnels through some sort of creative person. Like I have no delusions that my music, depending on your definition of original, it's not original, right? It's like, I like these kind of hip hop beats and I like heavy metal, and I'm sort of taking hip hop beats and I'm combining them with like heavy metal prog guitar parts. And then I'm adding some bass to it, right? It's the individual pieces aren't original, but what comes together is an original recipe because no one's quite put those Legos together the same way that I'm putting together. But those Lego pieces, I didn't make those Lego pieces. And I think Joseph Smith, I mean, I went down this rabbit hole, obviously really deep in my 20s. He pulled from a handful of different sources and books. He was way into occult folklore magic. Obviously, masonry, the temple ceremony is basically a retconned Mason ceremony. The Masons have a really long line of tradition and beliefs that have evolved over time. And I do think that because he was pulling from lots of other ancient sources, and Christianity itself is an ancient tradition, I do think he might have accidentally incorporated some small truths that survived, right? Not that he was, but because he was pulling from these ideas, some things might have made it through that actually have some merit to them. Like I said, we were talking about ancient civilizations. Obviously, the Book of Mormon believes in South America, or most Mormons believe that it took place in Central and South America. And the fact that they're running LIDAR and finding really old cities, 4 or 5 layers deep in the jungle, a lot of Mormons might think that that's proof that the Book of Mormon is true. But this idea was very prevalent in Joseph Smith's time, that the Native Americans actually came from a lost civilization that was destroyed. It wasn't like he didn't originate that idea. That idea has been around for a long time. He incorporated it into the lore of Mormonism. And maybe that idea had merit in it. Because, like, again, this archivist channel, is he's looking at different newspaper clippings from the early 1800s, which was Joseph Smith's time. And a lot of people were finding like burial grounds that were Native American, but they had like stonemasonry and metal workings, and the Native Americans at the time didn't have that technology. So that led people to believe like there was some sort of precursor civilization to the Native Americans descended from. And that very well, I think there's a high, like extremely high likelihood that that's true. But that doesn't mean that the Book of Mormon is true. And that day is coming, by the way. Like when we really start unearthing some of this stuff in South America, there's going to be a resurgence in Mormon faith because they're going to feel like that is evidence. But really what it is, it's evidence that one little idea in Mormonism has some validity to it.
Right. It's confirmation bias at that point, right? Yeah.
So that day is coming, but I think the whole idea of lost history is not only highly probable, again, because history is such a difficult discipline. We're going to find out new shit, but we also probably should talk about some video games. People right now are like, oh my God.
we just went down a rabbit hole. That was good.
There's actually a couple things I want to say before we move on. Sorry, guys. Friends sent me that article from Breaking Points about the 12 craft that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, I love that news station, by the way.
Breaking Points is awesome.
I fucking love them. They're so good. It feels genuinely like a news source that isn't incredibly biased or there isn't strings being pulled behind the scenes about what they're supposed to talk about. It genuinely feels like two people, one's conservative, one is liberal. They've got their own opinions, but they're telling you the news, giving you their opinions, and then kind of letting you believe what you want.
I like that they're very clear about what is the news and then what is their opinion or interpretation.
Right.
My brother and I have battled about Breaking Points because my brother is very worried. And I think there's truth to this worry because we know with like the IRA, Internet Research Agency, that was funded by the Russian state to spread just like crazy. They were funding, like, I think they found out that 12 or 13 of the top 15 Christian pages on Facebook were made by the Russian IRA
propaganda.
Russian propaganda. So Russian propaganda is a problem, and he's really worried about that. And he's been worried about just Russian propaganda for a long time. There's that famous clip of that guy in the 80s saying that this is how we're going to take over America. We're going to use propaganda and we're going to like get them to, he calls it boy tipping. We're going to like demasculate the men and do all these things. And that does seem to be coming true.
Yes.
Breaking Points criticizes the American system a lot. Like, they're pretty harsh. Like, yeah. And he's like, I don't like them because they're basically ragging on America all the time. And he suspects that maybe, like, they're funded by Russian money to, like, reduce American patriotism. And I'm like, okay, Russian propaganda is a problem. But do you have any evidence? Has there been any evidence uncovered that they're receiving money from any state actors? Have they ever reported on anything that was, like, grossly fake news where they've had to, like, you know,
rescind or talk rescind about
whatever? They haven't. And maybe the truth is that America is shitty right now, and we are corrupt, and we do have legitimate problems. And sure, maybe Russia, and that's a naturally occurring fire. And I could see how Russia or China would love to throw gas on that fire and cause more, like, division amongst the populace. So I think he's right that we need to be worried about that. But I think it's funny because he'll label me as a conspiracy theorist, but then he has this conspiracy about basically anyone who criticizes America, where he doesn't have any evidence. It's just, like, his hunch.
That sounds a little right wing to me, bud.
He's pretty liberal, but
is he? Okay.
Yeah, he's very left leaning. Well, on certain issues, I would say he's more liberal than he is conservative. And I'm actually probably more conservative than he is liberal. Yep. I think most people really are a mixed bag. And then the internet makes us believe that everyone is an extremist and we should all hate each other. Truth is, no, most of us are just normal people trying to get through life, make sense of what the fuck is going on. But you brought up they reported on the 12, going back to motifs in ancient history, like you had the six sages, the number 12. The 12 apostles, 12, like this number 12 keeps coming up. Have you ever heard of Zoroaster? He's credited to being the oldest monotheistic religion. So Zoroastrianism started in, like, 500 BC or something. Don't quote me on it. It predates Judaism and Christianity by a little bit, like a few generations. Zoroaster was a polytheistic priest, so he believed in many gods, like most people back in the day.
I like it.
He had an experience. This is the legend of Zoroaster, right? This is 3,000 some odd years old, so take it with a grain of salt. But the legend is that he was performing a ritual, a polytheistic ritual. He needed to cross a river as part of this ritual. When he crossed the river, he was fully submerged in the water, which is interesting. That's symbolic of baptism. While he was fully submerged in the water, he had a vision where he saw one light, a great white light, and 12 smaller lights surrounding it. And the great white light said, I am the one true God. I'm the God of all the gods. And to worship me, you have to do three things: good thoughts, good words, good deeds. And he came out of the water and became Zoroaster. And he started this new religion that was monotheistic. It's the oldest monotheistic religion that we know of. I actually would guess that 100 years from now, we'll discover evidence of a monotheistic religion older. Just like I said, because we haven't found everything. But as far as we know, it's the first monotheistic religion that believed in a singular being. And in his vision, he saw 12 lesser lights. And it's just like this motif of 12 tribes of Israel, 12 apostles. And then I'm like, it's definitely a stretch, but we have 12 crafts. I've always thought, like, if this phenomena that's piloting these crafts or creating drones or whatever they are, is so advanced that it can come here from another dimension or another galaxy or another timeline, wherever the fuck they're coming from, or the middle of the earth. I don't know. Nobody knows where they're coming from. But a lot of people in the UFO research world feel like these crashes aren't crashes. They were left intentionally.
Yeah.
I see YouTube comments like, they can travel the galaxy, but then they crash on Earth. What if they didn't really crash? What if they're left on purpose?
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. You can really go into a rabbit hole of UFOs helping to build the pyramids. That's a pretty common,
very common
conspiracy. Yeah. Granted, there's not a lot of evidence that it wasn't created that it was created by humans. It's a little bit too advanced for our time then. But what about, like, the first religions? Granted, like, imagine, when were the pyramids built? I don't even know, a couple thousand years ago. So imagine that these illiterate probably very dumb, just human beings. We weren't very smart back then. We didn't understand the natural world. We didn't understand science. And then fucking aliens come down out of the sky and build shit, and they're moving things with gravity and different technologies. Of course you're going to think they're gods, and of course you're going to make a religion after them. You're going to start worshiping them. And maybe 100%. That gets diluted through culture, through time, through other religions capturing the city that believes in a certain thing and then mixing. What if polytheistic or even monotheistic religions started with aliens building pyramids or assisting us in some way?
Or just like experiences, right? A mystical right. experience. Because the phenomena isn't always a craft, a physical craft. Like what got me into it is I don't think I saw a craft. I think what I saw was an orb. It's the most common thing. And orbs, from what everyone can tell, are energy. It's some sort of energetic phenomena. And it seemed intelligent. It put a show on for me. There was at least 12 other people, ironically, 12 other people around me, 12 to 13. I might've been the 13th person. Where'd you go to high school? I can't remember. You're from Orm High. Do you know about Unified Studies at Orm High back in the day?
No.
It's like an alternative nature-based education. Like you go on a hike, you have to triangulate where you go. That's your math. That's your geometry. While you're there, you have to look at some bedrock and do geology. Then you have to draw some plans for art. And then you have to they kind of mix everything together in like
a real
practical experience. And we were out camping in the Wedge, which is like central Utah. And a whole group of us, we're the buttfuck of nowhere, like 2 days hiking. There's nothing out there. No, there's no infrastructure. And we just saw a light like 100 feet in the air. It was close, like a street light. And I remember thinking, there's no street lights out here. Like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
And then it was just an orb. Then it grew. It changed colors. It was almost like a little kid saying, look at me. Look what I can do. I can do tricks. And it would change shape and change color and move around sporadically. Then it just blew up really big and dissipated and disappeared.
Jesus.
And I kind of, back then I was really Mormon. I had no context. I thought it was a craft then, not because I saw any visual evidence that there was a craft, but my brain had no concept of an orb or energy. I had never even heard of those ideas. So my mind was like, oh, that's got to be some sort of light system attached to some sort of craft. So I thought it was like a UFO, like some sort of craft. But there was no evidence of a craft. There was just the light. Then I got into the UFO research field after 2017. And that New York Times article came out, kind of validated that there was something going on. And it kind of gave me permission to believe my own experience. Because I was really skeptical. After I left Mormonism, I read The Demon Haunted World by Carl Sagan, and I kind of wrote off everything, including my own experience of maybe my eyes just played tricks on me. That was, I don't know, a rocket in the sky that got launched that day or something, even though there was no one announced anything. There's no evidence that happened. But after kind of learning that ATIP and OSAP existed and then going down the rabbit hole of the people who had experienced these things, these orbs happen all the time. And then I thought, that was a very mystical experience. And I think a lot of these, back to what you're saying, these religions, maybe they didn't necessarily see a ship come down and build a pyramid. Maybe that happened in Egypt. Maybe in other places, maybe Zoroaster had a vision and he was interacting with the same phenomena that's interacting with us now. And I like the term phenomena instead of alien, because we don't know what the phenomena is, right? We just have – the phenomena is a word. Back in the day, we'd see lightning and people thought it was Zeus, right? That interpretation of lightning is not correct. That doesn't mean that lightning isn't real just because some people had an interpretation of a phenomena that wasn't real.
Right.
So I think a lot of these ideas around what the phenomena is are going to turn out to be fake. I don't necessarily think it's like the grays and the tall whites and the reptilians. All those might be bullshit, but it doesn't mean that there isn't some sort of phenomena happening that human beings are experiencing. And I think what you're saying is highly likely that same phenomena was experienced by ancient humans and gave birth to religions because it was unexplainable.
Yeah. A lot of ancient humans or shamans in this case took a lot of psychedelics back in the day, and they would just imagine, just for a second, imagine what the night sky looks like. You know, you go to Southern Utah and it's pretty incredible to see the night sky in its most of its glory. Imagine a world 10,000 years ago with no pollution, no light pollution. Nothing. There's nothing. The sky probably looked insane. Now imagine taking copious amounts of psychedelics on top of that and then going to the king and like tapping his shoulder like, fucking bro, the gods are talking to us. And they would interpret and find constellations and they would interpret their world and make up stories. And that's how mythology started. They had to create meaning and they had to give stories. And they would use like, you know, there was a lot of thunder out or there was a lightning storm. Like, well, I don't understand static electricity and why that's building up or why it's striking down. Oh, maybe it's just Zeus. He's just pissed at us for this thing that you did earlier, King. So you got to make up for it by sacrificing her and him and her and him.
Yeah, yeah.
But a lot of our understanding of the natural world came from just looking at the stars, taking psychedelics, which is insane, and creating stories. And that's where all of this is coming from. So they very well could have seen spacecraft a lot. There could have been a lot going through. 10,000 years ago is nothing for the rest of the universe, right? Aliens have probably been coming to our planet for a long time. And maybe even more so back then because there was less activity and we were still very primal and there was less of us. But
I think there's something to it. Have you ever run across the gentleman by the name of Chris Bledsoe?
No.
He's not the most famous experiencer. I mean, you have Betty and Barney Hill, Travis Walton, you have Roswell, you have some really famous experiencers and events that have made it into like the mainstream culture. But Chris Bledsoe is by far the most studied experiencer. He has been studied by the DOD, the DIA, NASA, CIA. Jim Semivan was the director of operations for CIA for like 20 years. Good friends with him. He just wrote a book called UFO of God. You should definitely check him out. His son has a podcast called Bledsoe Said So. I'm a Patreon. I pay $5 a month to be in this private Discord.
Cool.
This family is legit. They've been having experiences and there's orbs outside this dude's house every day. And the government basically follows him around because for some reason, the phenomena is really active around him. And a lot of people, he has a more spiritual take. He believes that it's less nuts and bolts and more of an energetic or spiritual phenomena, and that it can present itself as technology and it can manifest technology, but underneath it, it's a more of a consciousness phenomena, which I'm starting to become more of a panpsychist, meaning I think consciousness is fundamental and matter emerges from consciousness instead of consciousness emerging from matter, which is our current view. Right. There's the three dudes that won the most recent Nobel Prize. And I don't understand the physics or the science, but they allege that they proved that the universe is non-local and it doesn't render until it is observed by some sort of consciousness, which is a great segue into video games. Because when I listen to that, that makes me think of a video game engine. You have all these ideas of like the Akashic records where all knowledge is stored somewhere in some spiritual realm. And if you think of a video game engine, right, you have the player, you have your character, and then you have the camera. To save on computing power, like if you're in an open world game, the game is not rendering the entire world. It's only rendering what it needs to based on where you're pointing the camera.
Right.
But the rules and the data that make up the whole world are on the hard drive, right? This tree goes there. This NPC is there. But it's not actually rendered into the game world until you make a choice and go through your action, force that character now is rendered into the game world because you went there to talk to that character. And so the rest of reality is not rendered. It's only there as potential. Mm. And that potential is only realized if someone, a consciousness, makes a choice.
Observes it,
right? And so that's this idea of the non-local universe that, again, I read through this whole Scientific American article, and I'll tell you right now, I understood -10%. But apparently, through this crazy weird experiment with particle colliders and double-blind this and that, they were able to illustrate that the universe is non-local. It doesn't render locally. It renders upon observation.
Crazy.
So things are getting really, really weird. And I think the video game is a great analogy. The idea of the Matrix has been around forever. I think these ideas come up because human beings have an intuition, but we don't know enough, like you said. So we come up with stories that are an approximation. Again, Zeus isn't a great description of lightning, but it's what we had at the time.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that lightning's not real. It just means we've evolved our story to explain the phenomena of lightning over time.
Right. Agreed. Yeah. The idea that computers or video games are in itself its own reality. Certainly we have created them to do what we want. And the character can kind of navigate and interact with objects and people and NPCs. What happens when, now this is super, super anime of me, but what, I guess it's not anime. This is pretty mainstream sci-fi. What happens when we can't tell the difference between VR and real life? What happens when you spend so much time in a video game that is your reality? There's two realities and it doesn't exist until you observe it, but which one is real just because we created it? What if it took over all of our senses and transported us through all of our senses into a game and we're a level 70 orc and we're raiding dungeons?
How do you define real? Because if you're experiencing it, if you want to say that's your fundamental definition of reality, if a consciousness experiences it, you could argue that's real. It's kind of like people say dreams aren't real, but I'm like, but I experience in them and I'm real. And you're like, it's just in your head. Okay, but my brain is real. And if my brain is generating some crazy dream, then you could argue that that dream is real because it's a product of my brain. And I don't know if dreams are just in your head, right? There might be more to dreams. I've had some really, really weird mystical dreams in my day.
Yeah.
I think that you could argue that the simulation of a video game is just as real because a consciousness is experiencing it. And that's what reality is. It's like, that's like the age old question. If a tree falls in the woods, no one can hear it. Did it really make a sound?
Right.
It's like, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
I bring this up because I've been saying this for the past, like, this is kind of a recent thing. In the past few years that I've told people that my retirement plan is to be an old painter who does plein air. I just go out into the woods and do paintings of landscapes and animals and shit. But then I come home to my assisted living retirement home with a community of other people like our age who are into video games and shit. And we just go home, we plug into VR and we're fucking level 70 orcs and we raid dungeons together. And then I wake up the next day and like half of my life is in VR, like real legitimate, takes over all of your senses. You've got Elon Musk's Neuralink stuck into the back of your fucking head and you're just laying on the bed getting atrophied. All of your muscles are withering away. You've got an IV plugged into your arm. Maybe a little testosterone because we're still banging at that age for sure.
Yeah, I think some weird stuff like that is coming. I think we're entering an age where a lot of preconceptions are going to get overturned and we're going to have some jumps, right? Like I said, science is going to be updating based on the overwhelming evidence and there's going to be some things that are going to get overturned. Wow, we were really wrong about A, B, and C. Or certain things are going to get augmented. Like we were 20% right about A, but we've got to augment 80% of it with this new evidence.
Right.
I think that's coming down the pipe. I think a lot of dogma, because science, the scientific method is the best tool we have to understand reality. But the institution of sciences are run by people and they're subject to the same issues that religion has with rigidity and dogma and ego and suppressing evidence that goes against your bias. And then we can get into like big money funding science and pushing it to get a certain result. And that's not really the scientific method. That's like corrupting the scientific method to push a narrative out, which is happening too. I mean, we look at our healthcare system and it's like, we've never been more unhealthy. Life expectancy is going down, but like no one can explain why. I think it's because a lot of our health and food and pharmaceuticals and drugs have just been overtaken by, there's still good real science going on, but it's battling the big money science. I mean, I think cigarettes are the base, right? Because you can get into like other stuff with like trans fats or vaccines. And those are very like controversial subjects, right? And people get caught up. So I said, but everybody knows cigarettes are bad now. Like there's no question.
Yep. Yeah.
But for a long time, for 70, 50, 70 years, that was a gray area. people knew cigarettes were bad, but the cigarette industry was funding science and disinformation. And it took a long time for mainstream regulators to say, like, actually, you can't advertise to kids, and you have to put these warning labels, and you have to do all this stuff. And they kicked that ball down the road, even though the science was clear. They knew it. Everybody knew it. These things are causing heart attacks. They're causing lung cancer. But it took 50 to 70 years for that to become the standard way of thought. And they were able to delay that evidence and delay all of that with big money. And that, yep, that playbook has been around. They weren't the first ones to do it, but I like to bring that one up because everybody knows that. I mean, most people have seen Thank You for Not Smoking, yeah, which is a great fictional story based on a lobbyist for the cigarette industry. And I think that same thing is going on right now. I mean, we know, like, pharmaceutical companies, they come out with drugs. They may last for 5 or 6 years. The evidence gets overwhelming. They're causing side effects. There's a class action lawsuit. They make $10 billion, pay out $2 billion in a lawsuit. They profit $8 billion, rinse and repeat.
Right.
I think that has muddied the water when it comes to the science around health. And I would argue that that's not real science. The scientific method doesn't go into a study with a preconceived idea.
Yeah, they have things that they want to prove or disprove, but it's not going in to say, you need to prove that cigarettes aren't bad for you. Here's 30 million.
Yeah.
Pocket 5 of this for yourself. We got some lobbyists behind us. Yeah, for sure.
So that's where I think a lot of that's going to start, because people are, including myself, right? I think COVID, we've lost a lot of trust in the news. We've talked about news and breaking points. We've lost a lot of trust, but I think we need to be careful to not lose trust in the scientific method. That's where I'm a little worried about. Like, I straddle between liberal thinking and conservative thinking. And I'm like, I think the conservatives are right with some of the shallow end of the conspiratorial thinking. I think there's some validity to it. But yeah, I'm worried that people are like, they conflate science, the industry that's susceptible to the corruption of money and human beings, with the scientific method. I think those two things are separate. The scientific method should be put on a fucking pedestal. This is the best tool we have. It's not perfect, but it is the best tool we've come up with describing reality and getting all human beings to have a consensus agreement on what is and what isn't. And we cannot abandon that tool just because an industry has taken that tool and used it for the purpose it wasn't designed for.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of felt like during the pandemic, now this is just my own take, I'm not an expert on politics, but it felt like the left was very pro-vaccine, pro-science, and they were just like, let's get the vaccine done, let's shelter in place, we really want to care about the people who are dying. And, you know, there's a lot of good in that message. But on the other side of that were Republicans saying, like, no, this is still big pharma pitching a drug to us that was made in 6 months. And there's, you know, a lot of people saying that weren't very informed, but I have the same problem you do, is I straddle that line of like, I get the left and what they're feeling. And I got vaccinated myself because I got COVID in 2020. And dude, I was afraid to go to sleep for a couple nights. I could barely breathe just laying down in the middle of the day. So I was afraid to go to sleep. And then the next February or March, the vaccine came out. And because I was working for a mental health facility.
Yeah, I want to get this again. Yeah.
Yeah. So I worked for a mental health facility and got it early. So I got the first two shots and I was like, cool, great. Like, I didn't want to come close to death again. I didn't want to spread it. The science was still kind of up in the air about how bad COVID was. We assumed it was going to be a lot worse than it turned out to be. Not to say that the people that died was a total waste, or that I'm not thinking of that, but all of the sudden I went from not trusting from before the pandemic, not trusting big pharma in any way, because I knew what they were doing with all kinds of drugs and painkillers and
the opioid crisis. Yeah.
The opiates were like fucking like about the time that you and I met, a little bit before that actually was the phase in my life where I was really struggling with addiction, and I was doing a lot of drugs, and I was doing opiates, I was doing psychedelics, I was drinking, I was smoking, I was doing everything that I could get my hands on. So I was afraid of opiates because I saw my friends dying from it. Like, pharmaceutical drugs were killing my friends. And that was a big deal for me. That was like, that sucked. So I turned away from Big Pharma in most cases, right? Not in every single pill or medicine that ever comes out. Like, obviously there are some good ones, but we went from trusting to not trusting Big Pharma to the pandemic. And we were all so scared that we started trusting Big Pharma. And these are the same people that were killing people before this. They had been doing the same thing. And then all of a sudden they have a vaccine that was supposed to work forever. And then it turned out, oh, it's like, you know, 8 months that it'll work for about 8 months. And then you got to get like 7 more boosters. But then it turned out to be like, I don't know, what is it now? 5 months before you have to get a booster. And then there's all the COVID variants. And then all of a sudden we just don't talk about it anymore. So I constantly flip from being like, yeah, I am liberal in the sense that I care about people, but I'm conservative in the sense like, fuck Big Pharma, fuck that whole weird, there's just so much gray area there.
Yeah, I think the left is right in the sense of we should trust science, but the right is right in saying that I don't know if this science is being done the way it's supposed to be done.
Right.
And that's where I think the right was, again, I think the shallow end of the conspiracy pool, which some people would consider the deep, but I've been to the deepest fringes, right? I've watched Flat Earth documentaries. Like, I've been everywhere, right? And there's some really crazy shit out there that has very little evidence. So when I say shallow end, it's meaning like, hey, maybe Big Pharma is just trying to make money. Like, that's not an out there conspiracy because they've done it before,
not.
Right?
Yeah, it's not.
Now, the issue with the conservative side is they were taking an idea that has merit. Like, can we trust the science coming from Big Pharma? Because they have shown us in the past that we can't. And then, like a Mormon reading the Book of Mormon, getting a good feeling, they make this huge logical jump that it's actually 5G and it's going to turn us all into zombies. It's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, you just went from a really good idea to like, holy shit. Like, that's a really big leap, dude. Like, I'm with you on the, like, let's be skeptical of pharma.
Yeah.
But where's the evidence that this is 5G. Linked to 5G and that there's some weird black goo in the vaccine and they're going to flip 5G on and control the whole world? Like, one, that didn't happen. And two, the evidence for that is really thin, where the evidence for Big Pharma just wanting to make money and not caring about the ethics is everywhere.
Normal. That's normal America. That's pretty normal.
Yeah. So that's why I think that whole thing was so hard, because every controversial subject, the reason it's controversial is there's truth on both sides. The left was right in the sense of, hey, you should, we're in a pandemic, you should trust the science. But that's assuming the science is being done non-biased and being done correctly.
Right. And not for profit.
Like, and not for profit. Yes.
Right. Right.
And if that's the case, then yeah, we should trust it. And then the other thing that I didn't like is what ends up, and this happens with, again, ancient history, it's happened in UFOs. Now that they've disclosed that Operation Blue Book was a disinformation campaign to make to discredit UFOs by any means necessary and to obscure, and they would put out wild conspiracy theories to make the whole subject seem like bullshit so people would write it off, is manufactured appearance of consensus. So the idea was like, the science is out. All the scientists agree, all the doctors agree that vaccines are safe. But the reality is there wasn't as much consensus. It's just that the people that were speaking out and had issues were getting suppressed or getting labeled or had PR campaigns to make them all look like kooks. Some of them were kooks. That's the hard part. Some of them were kooks. And so you can amplify those kooks and then say, everyone who thinks this way is crazy, and that all the smart people are in consensus. But I almost got vaccinated. I was really, really nervous. I didn't get COVID I think I got COVID actually before we knew COVID was happening, because I got really, really sick in like January, February. And then everything kind of hit in March. And then there were studies saying that maybe it had been in America as early as October of 2019.
Right.
I'm not really sure. So I got like the worst flu of my life, like 12 days. I couldn't function, like just wrecked. Yeah. Might have been COVID, might have not been. Didn't lose my taste and smell.
Yeah. On top of that, there's the social pressures of people weren't allowed to go back to work. There was a point at my job where they weren't saying this, but they were saying like, you need to get vaccinated soon. We're giving it to you early, or you're going to have to like go through all these hoops to get back to work. And it was like basically saying, if you don't get a vaccine, you're not going to work. So you need to get a vaccine. So on top of that, I was like, fuck, I have to keep going to work. I have to work. There's no way. Like at that time, I wasn't making a lot of money. I was barely paying my bills. You know, as an artist, you kind of sacrifice your career path and how much money you're making for a little extra time in your free time, or it's a job that doesn't take your energy from you so you can create something as a musician and a podcaster and a video game player. Like, surely you understand
100%
the sacrifice you have to make. And then the entire convention scene had shut down in 2020. And that's Comic Cons, that's fantasy cons, it's video game cons on top of that. And a huge source of my income as an artist at that time was traveling to conventions. I was traveling to Canada, I was going to Vegas, I did some in Nevada, I was going to Reno, fucking California for Comic Cons. I was going all over the country in different parts of the world to make money. And that just shut down completely. So I was scared on multiple fronts. I was scared for my life because I felt like I was fucking dying. There was like one point when I was just laying in my bed with my like eyes, like they weren't closed, but I couldn't focus on anything. It was just blurry, like the background of your screen right now. Like,
yeah.
And it was just like I had Hunter x Hunter, the anime, on my laptop. And I'm just like, just like sweating and afraid to go to sleep that night because I was like fucking so close to death. And I was in decent shape. You know, I'm not like a fucking marathon runner, but I went to the gym 4 times a week. I was working out. I was eating fairly healthy. And I had a roommate at the time. I'm not going to say his name, but he wasn't in the greatest shape. He played video games all day long and he ate fast food all the time. And he got COVID and just had a little scratch in the back of his throat and was over it in like a week. And I was
so weird.
What the fuck, man? Like, I just got wrecked. I got put on my ass. So it was scary.
It was wild times. I mean, I'm glad we could catch up on that. I think people, the pandemic, you know, for those of you listening that many of you might disagree with my opinion or Chase's opinions, and that's fine. But I think it was such a big experience for everyone. It's therapeutic for me to be able to talk to someone. And even I know that even if you disagree, like, we're not going to hate each other and stop being friends. Like,
right.
And people need to data dump and sort of communicate what it was like for them to just sort of process the experience and move on. I think we're still dealing with the after effects psychologically of that whole thing. We're obviously for still sure. dealing with it politically, right? It divided the country. The country was already just in bad shape politically already, really bad shape.
2016 was a good year for us.
Yeah. And it just made things worse. And I think the reason why I'm like, well, let's talk about it is one, I need to talk about it personally, but two, it's like, set an example. Like, look, we can talk about these things and not hate each other, even if we disagree. And right. I think enough time has passed where maybe it's a less sensitive. And when you hear someone with a disagreeing opinion, instead of believing what the internet has told us, which is we have to hate anyone who disagrees with us, which is just a symptom of maybe foreign propaganda, but really social media algorithms, it's, you know, clicks make dollars. And outrage makes clicks. And so it rewards the most extreme voices. And we get this sense that everyone out there is an extreme right or extreme left. But really, that's a small percentage of the population. And everyone is like you and me. And we're just trying to make sense of it. And we don't know. We straddle sometimes, depending on the day, I might be more right-leaning on a subject. And then I might listen to a podcast. And maybe that'll sway me more left-leaning for the next 6 months. And like, I don't know. I'm not married to any of them because I'm just a dude. Like, I have a job. I have a family. Like, I can't spend – I'm not full-time trying to figure all this stuff out.
Right.
I'm trying to like listen to something like Breaking Points is a source that I'm outsourcing my research to them, hoping that they're going to aggregate the information in a quick way that I can digest it, make a couple decisions. Then I got to go make money and pay my bills.
Right. Yeah. I think most people are pretty malleable in their belief systems, but social media and other medias have the tendency to push one side or the other. Like you and I, we've gone to both sides of this conversation back and forth, conservative, liberal, right in the middle. Like nobody's really, the people that who are far left or far right are fucking insane. Have you ever met someone in real life who is far left or far right? They're so hard to be around. They're so insufferable. And you're just like, what? where am I, right? And you want to like put your hands in your armpits and just like smell the sweat on your fingers because you'd rather do that than listen to this person talk.
It was a crazy time. I think, I mean, we're we're coming out of that particular issue. We have lots of other issues coming forward. Again, we've talked a little bit about AI before we started recording, and you're an artist.
Yeah.
For those who didn't listen to the first episode, now that we're an hour in, thanks for sticking in. We're going to talk about some real video game shit. Let's do a quick overview for those that listened to the first episode. What was your first console? What did you play? Kind of give us a quick rundown of what did you play growing up? What are your tastes? And then segue into how that got you into art, and then we can go from there.
My very first experience, if I can go back deep into the vaults of trauma and childhood abuse from my parents. Just kidding, Mom. I love you. My first console was a regular Nintendo. I remember having Mario, the first Mario, Super Mario. No, first Mario game. And then, oh man, Duck Hunter, you know, early, early old school games. It was so early into my memories. I remember Super or regular Nintendo. I remember a lot of my neighborhood friends had a bunch of different games. You know, everybody kind of has that one neighborhood friend who's got like every video game, and you go to their house, you don't even like them, but you just want to play like fucking like Battletoads with them or something.
Yeah.
And you're just like, I know that your parents know I'm here for the video games, but I don't give a shit. So I mostly remember what my friends had early on. And then I got my first serious system was a 64. Sega came out after that.
What was the first game you felt like, I'm a gamer?
The game that I really fell in love with. Fucking James Bond, dude.
That's a big one, yeah.
The James Bond GoldenEye. Like, just the PvP, fighting each other for the first time on a split screen. Like, I'm sure there were games before that that were doing stuff like that. But it was GoldenEye. GoldenEye was the first one that really got me and my friends into some serious gaming. And then like Diddy Kong Racing, anything where you were like playing with friends and you're like, this is the greatest fucking day of my life. And you play all night and you posted something on your Instagram. It was like, I ordered pizza. My mom doesn't care. I'm staying up late. I've got a gallon of Mountain Dew and it's Diablo 4 came out. It is 2023. And you're 39 years old or something. That's what it felt like today. Eventually we'll get into the new Diablo game because I'm playing that right now and Tears of the Kingdom. So we got a few more steps before we get there. But yeah, those first couple games for sure. Tons of N64 games. That was my favorite console at the time. I had friends with PlayStations and shit. And I was just like, nah, man, like, I don't know. PlayStation never felt right to me. It wasn't like as goofy. I loved Nintendo games so much because of the style. There was a lot of like fun. I'm trying to think. Crash Bandicoot was a good one for the PlayStation. Obviously Tomb Raider. There were some early classics, but I grew up on a Nintendo. So I'm very like, you know, it's like some people are DC or Marvel. I grew up on DC, so I'm more partial to that. Some people don't like DC. It's whatever, right? They're all great. But the 64 was just like, I love the style. I love the goofiness. I love the characters. I loved the music. Let's see, after that was the GameCube, of course. A bunch of games on the GameCube. NBA Street Ball was a super fun game. And there's a lot of little games in between. Obviously, like, I had a Game Boy and played Pokemon Red and Blue. And, like I'm an early OG. Like, I played all the classics. I grew up with them. Like, it's part of my childhood playing these games. And I wasn't super great at school. I struggled with ADHD as a kid. It really affected my performance for all the way till high school. And I really, really struggled in school. So I spent a lot of time daydreaming in school, and video games were like a real life daydream for me. So that escape from a harsh reality, I wouldn't say it was harsh, a reality that I created for myself that was difficult. Video games were that escape for me, and it's always been that way. And, you know, I graduated to Xbox 360.
So you made the switch from Nintendo to Xbox at the 360 generation?
I think at the original Xbox, Nintendo to Xbox.
Because GameCube and Xbox, the OG Xbox, were around the same time, same generation.
Yeah, because I remember having the GameCube for a while and then the Xbox and then a 360. I think my little brother had a 360, but I was like just about to graduate. I think I was in high school or leaving high school around that time. So I stopped playing as much 360. I remember the Halo came out. Those games were obviously amazing. And then my real addiction, the real, like the real, the fucking game that sunk its claws into me was World of Warcraft. I was, this was a few years before you and I met. This was right when Obama got elected in his first years. I was playing 8 to 10 hours a day of World of Warcraft. I was raiding dungeons. I was leveling characters. I would go work part-time at a dry cleaner in the day, come home, play World of Warcraft all day, all night long, go to bed, wake up, do the same thing. And then on the weekends, I was taking like 3 or 4 double stack ecstasies, putting them in my butt, railing it off of the countertop, like drinking. Like I was doing hard drug. Like it was just addiction in general. Yeah. But I was doing.
And World of Warcraft was part of that addiction too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was an escape. It was an escape from the in-between times when I couldn't take drugs. Like I'd go to work to pay for bills so I could play video games and do drugs on the weekends. And that was like, I loved it. It was a problem. Obviously it's not a problem for me now playing video games, not like that, because I got over addiction. And what got me out of addiction, what got my head straight was just having something to plan for and hope for. Cause there wasn't a lot of hope in that time for me. It was kind of a rough point in my life when I didn't know what to live for, you know, and drugs were just kind of that. They were just kind of that like escape. It was the thing that made me not feel the pain. It was very numbing. And then I started going to school to be an aircraft mechanic. Cause like, maybe I should like kind of get a career. Maybe I could be an aircraft mechanic. I was going to Salt Lake Community College at the Salt Lake Airport. I did that for 1.5 years. Turns out I fucking hated it. I loved aircraft and like mechanic stuff because, you know, I grew up with that with my dad. And then I started drawing in my classes just to keep my mind busy because I was bored as shit because I hated it. And then I was at that time, I was slowly not using drugs as much, whether it was because I couldn't afford it or that my friends were dying around me or, you know, various reasons. But I switched to being an artist. I switched my major to illustration. I went to UVU, and this was about 22. And this is when you and I met.
This is when I met. Yeah. So you had, I didn't know. I mean, we met playing Smash.
Yeah.
We met at a Smash tournament with my buddy Todd, who's also been on the podcast. And I think I knew at the time you were doing art because I had done a couple art classes, but I didn't know at the time, or maybe you weren't as into art then, you were just starting. Because my memory of you being an artist, like hardcore addicted to doing art, which is a good addiction, like a discipline, that a skill,
right,
came like later as we stayed in contact online.
Yeah. So you and I met in the 2D design class, which is a very early art class. It's like something you take in your first or second semester of school, because most people have to get some kind of art credit, and 2D design was one of those. But unless you were, I think that one was 4 majors. So if you were in the arts program, because I know there was photographers and there was some other people, but most of the time it was just a general art class for most people. So that's when you and I met, and that's when I had just started doing art. So I wasn't, there was nothing to look at. I might've had a sketchbook to show you, but I was, you know, I was just starting out.
Yeah.
Like, I went from zero skill and having no experience drawing ever in my life, like never being seen as an artist or doing art, to going to school and then meeting you maybe 4 or 5 months after that. So it was pretty early on. And then from there, I was just trying to pass the required classes to get into the illustration program and build up a portfolio that was good enough that they would accept me. So maybe 2 or 3 years after you and I met is when I got into the program. And then I don't know how much longer until I graduated and, well, quote unquote, graduated. I left in 2016 after finishing all my art classes and ignoring all of my gen ed classes, which I kind of regret now. I'll tell you why a little bit later. But, and so I left school in 2016. Video games were the reason I got into art. I remember thinking, and discovering that there were concept artists out in the world who were designing monsters for video games, and that was a fucking job. Are you kidding me? You can design monsters and make 100,000 working for Blizzard or upwards to that. Like, you can make insane money being a concept artist. And I was like, oh, this is where all of my talents and interests are going to merge together. And this is my career. I don't give a fuck how hard it is. And I have this like blind confidence that comes from a little bit of ignorance, a little bit of ego, and, you know, probably some other issues going on with me. But I was just dumb enough to be like, yeah, I could just do this and go to school and be an artist for a living and get a job as a concept artist. And it took me 3 to 4 years to figure out like, oh shit, I am not anywhere near good enough. It's going to take me a decade to get there. Might not get a job at being a concept artist, but that's okay because I can still make art in my free time and do it for me with the idea that I'm going to turn it into a career path for sure. I've never doubted that it's going to be that way for me. I've never once questioned it. It's just been like, for me, it was either addiction and dying from drugs or being an artist. And for me, that was just like, yeah, there's no turning around after I go to school for this. So you met me early on when we were just, you know, just getting my feelers out for being an artist and still developing my style. And then post 2016, I got a tattoo apprenticeship in Salt Lake.
I remember talking to you about this at the gym. Yeah.
I remember seeing you at, Orem
Vasa? You had just got, the Orem Vasa. You had just got accepted. Yeah.
So I left school to do that because I was like, well, that's my career path. There we go. Cause they make fucking $200 an hour if you're good enough. Like,
yeah,
they're really good and you can make some decent money. And, you know, it's arguably, it's one of the cooler art forms. A lot of cool guys are tattooing people. So that was kind of my career path. I had chosen that. After about 6 months of that, it just fell apart. It wasn't a terrible experience, but I could just tell that the guy who was training me knew that I wasn't passionate about it. He could tell that it wasn't like that I didn't fit in. It was just like the community, like, of tattoo artists, there's a lot of really good people in that community, but there's a lot of shitheads in that community too. And you know, everyone who works or has gotten tattooed has met one of those people in the industry. And I'm not saying the guy that I apprenticed under is a shithead. We really fell apart. Like, it was kind of like, it felt like a breakup with a bad ex, like a bad relationship. Cause it just, the pain of getting of that failure for me lingered for years afterwards. Yeah. And there are still times when I moved back up to, when I moved up to Salt Lake a year and a half ago, I was worried that I would run into people at that shop. Like, the chances of me running into them are like next to nothing. Cause there's so many people up here. But the pain of that resurfaced when I moved up, and occasionally I would drive past the old shop and it would like give me nerves, and like I would get nervous, and it was just such a hard, I don't often talk about this, but it really hurt. It really fucked me up. I thought I was going to quit doing art because I didn't see another path to making good money like that. That was such a clear path to success. And then I had to fall back onto my nothing plan that I had while I was in college. So there was this period in 2016 where I was almost ready to quit and just like do it for fun every once in a while and work some shit job that I hated or, you know, whatever. And what got me out of that was this workshop in Calgary, Alberta, up in Canada. My sister lives up there, but there was this group of American artists who traveled to different parts of the country. Are different like national monuments. They do a lot of hiking. They do like a week of that. And then they do workshops at the end of it to be an artist, to like develop your style, just like various workshops, stuff like that. So at that point they were doing some hiking in Banff up at the national park there, which is insane. It's beautiful up there. It's like Utah on steroids. It's gorgeous. So we did the workshop and then it like cracked me back open. They had like they call them the First Peoples. They don't call them Native Americans up there. Like, the First Peoples chief came to our workshop and blessed the workshop with some like song and chant. And it was like beautiful. And it cracked me open. And I, on the drive home, I was like crying. It was like a 12-hour drive. And I'm just like fucking hysterical, like feeling like I had really healed after that experience in that workshop. Coming back and then restarting my kind of freelance fantasy art portfolio that I'm working on now, which is my current portfolio. And now, well, let me take a few steps back. In college, when we met, I was leaving the church for good, like mentally and emotionally, and I was taking psychedelics at the same time, and that really cracks me open, thinking about mm-hmm. religion and taking acid and reading about mythology and getting sucked into Hindu mythology. And just like, yeah, you can imagine, like I would put on like 10 hours plus hours of like mythology videos and documentaries on YouTube in a big playlist. And I would trip on acid and just like stare at my screen and just like rewire my brain. I did that a couple times. So my obsession with like storytelling and the ancient world, that's why I was talking about Randall Carlson. Randall
Carlson. Yeah. Randall Carlson.
And so my obsession with him and like them kind of discovering the old world and having evidence for that. And that's why I brought that up earlier, because it's so fascinating to think that there is more culture that we're missing or more technology that we're missing out on. And that kind of sparked an idea for me that I wanted to create more than just paintings, you know, because a lot of times with artists, you just create a painting and then you sell the painting. That's your business model. You create a product, you sell the product. Sometimes you can make prints. A lot of artists will make prints of their work, like nice glossy paper prints, and they'll sell them at conventions, $25, $30 a pop, and you can sell an unlimited amount. And that's kind of what the convention plan was. But I wanted a larger purpose than just a portfolio of prints that I could sell. And I had a friend looking at my portfolio. His name is Justin Mayhew. He's another artist I went to school with. He was looking at my portfolio and he's like, you know, a lot of your work is like, it all looks really good and it all matches. And I see a story in here, but what's the story? What's your theme? Why do you do gods and goddesses? What's the point of all this? And that really like fucked me up a little bit. I was like, oh shit, my work is pointless. And he didn't mean that by any means, but it's like one of those crushing critiques that are transformative in a sense, that change the way that you view your art and kind of recalibrate. Like when you take acid and stare at 10 hours of mythology videos, you like rewire your artistic brain. And I'm sure you felt the same way about your music. One day you just had an epiphany from a critique and you're just like, oh, I'm doing this wrong. The whole thing is fucking wrong. And I can do this in a different way. And I get very animated when I start talking about my work, because this is me on the inside. I don't often express myself personally to people, but I love talking about my work because in a sense, it's a transformation of me and it's certainly a representation of who I am. So if you just want to know who I am, look at my work and you can extract what you want. But the reason that ancient archaeology stuff is super fascinating with Graham Hancock, especially, that guy's a fucking genius. I wanted to tell a story. I wanted to tell stories, but I couldn't write. Like, I can barely paint at the time. Like, even now, I'm like, yeah, I can paint, but like, whatever. I want story to go along with it because that always gives things substance. There's more you can do with a written story. So I came up with this idea that was sparked by a friend. I was like looking for a writer and I posted on Facebook, like, hey, if you guys know any writers, I need somebody to write some stories about my paintings. And one of my friends sent me a story that he came up with, a quick short story about an archaeologist who discovered, like, one of my landscape paintings had some floating rocks. And it was like a story of this archaeologist in the field who discovered these floating rocks for the first time. And he's like, what? So he's like trying to discover why these rocks are floating. And I can't remember the whole story, the way he wrote, but it sparked an idea. What if this archaeologist is kind of like my experience, where I rediscovered the gods and tried to prove that they really existed, because I left religion and I'm looking for some kind of belief system to fill holes and whatever. Mm-hmm. So what if this archaeologist is trying to prove that these gods in my paintings actually existed? And so from there, I fleshed out this world called the Book of Olith. This is the overarching concept of all of my artwork, that this guy named Reed is sort of a, I don't even know what to call this, a celestial archaeologist or a mythological archaeologist. His father ends up going missing when he was young because he was studying the same thing that he is now. And his obsession with trying to find his father led him to go on these funded research trips to like find artifacts to prove that the gods existed, because there's kind of, people still kind of believe in them, but there's like stories of the gods leaving the planet and just kind of leaving people as they were, just to like rot and die. And the world is kind of falling apart. But this guy is desperate to not only find his father, but to prove that they all existed. So the story is about Reed going on this journey, finding out if the gods existed. One of his trips, he discovers the Book of Oleth itself. So the project is called Book of Oleth, and Reed discovers the Book of Oleth. So in the book that I paid somebody to write, my friend Fish Burton, coolest name in the planet. Fish Burton is such a rad dude. He wrote this like incredible story that's a mix of like prose poetry and traditional fantasy storytelling. When Reed opens the book to start translating, the book changes into this prose poetry style that's very abstract and just gorgeous writing. So this project and this book has been coming together for the past, oh man, since 2018, right before the pandemic, I'd been working on this. The story has gone through a full rewrite. I had somebody else rewrite the whole story. Fish is the second writer in the book. And I've been working on this, and there has just been so many like hiccups that's taken this forever. Of course, I can't release any project during the pandemic. So that pushed everything back a few years. You know, conventions shut down. I couldn't sell the book then. So I just kind of took my time working with my graphic designer and my writer. We got the book done. It is graphic designed. And this is a great segue into talking about the Kickstarter that is coming out. And I was going to originally do July, but August is kind of when we're going to jump this off. And this book is the culmination of all of my work for the past 12 years of me being an artist. This is every ounce of my creative energy wrapped up into a single book, a tome.
Is it the book itself? Is it a book about the book in your lore? The Book of Elo, right?
Is Oleth, Olith. So if my website is bookofoleth.com, you can see that all my social media is Art of Chase. The Book of Oleth is the name of the book that I'm making, but it is also the book that Reed discovers in his journeys that proves that the gods existed. So it's sort of this like third person, I don't know if that's even the right term, but it's like this meta, like, my book that I'm creating is my discoveries of my artwork and the story that was found inside of my paintings. And it is the Reed's discovery of the gods himself.
That is badass. So August, you're launching the Kickstarter. What's your goal? Yeah.
The goal is to just get it printed, man. I'm not even asking for a lot of money. I think my fully funded goal is like 25 to 3,000. I'm not even asking for a lot, because I just need like 300 copies, and then it'll steamroll into, I can sell it and then rebuy prints. And
yeah,
obviously I want it to do as good as possible, but I'll fund it myself if I have to. I'm just, the Kickstarter has to happen. I have to do this not only for myself or for my wallet. Like, I just have to do this. This is the only thing that, like, one of the few things that fucking matters to me besides my lovely girlfriend, who I know is going to be listening to this. So I have to drop her name. Art is the only thing that wakes me up. It's the only thing that gets me to work. I'm an art teacher at a treatment center for kids with learning disabilities. So I deal with a lot of kids with ADHD or just slight learning disabilities. I wouldn't say that they're disabled in any way, but they're in a residential treatment center. So they're living there, and they're junior high to high school age, small classroom sizes. And we just get to like explore basic art. And, you know, anybody with ADHD really, and I'm sure you've experienced it with other people, maybe yourself, but just having a creative venture really keeps your focus and like gives you kind of joy and gives you like something to work towards. So it's really nice to like be able to give back to like younger guys, younger boys that I never thought I would enjoy, but it's really something that I really love. But I don't know where I was going with that, but the book is hopefully going to launch 1st of August, 2nd of August. I don't really have like an exact timeline. You know, Kickstarter runs for a month, so it's not super important on what day I launch in August. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to spend too much time promoting my own stuff. I wanted to talk about some more video games. I think we've talked about my work enough. I have a huge bone to pick with Elden Ring. I fucking hate Elden Ring. I hate it. You can't
I'm going to hang up right now. Bye. Just kidding.
So the graphics, let's talk about a few things that were amazing with it, right? The graphics were amazing.
The art direction.
The artwork
is unparalleled.
But the gameplay, you can't just make a game hard as fuck and say that it's like, oh, it's like, it's like such good game design. It's like the mechanics and the fucking, obviously the storytelling and the concepts were great. You can't just make a game hard as fuck and be like, yeah, it's the best game ever, 'cause no one can beat it. And only like real gamers can beat it. I have a few hours a day to play video games. If that, like maybe every couple days I play for an hour or two. I don't want to spend my time getting bent over by a flaming salamander over and over and over because I need this one fucking samurai sword. And it was so infuriating for like the first 10 to 15 hours. I was like, oh, this is really fun. And then I would just get bent over in dungeons and I would spend hours getting fucked up. And I hate that kind of gameplay. I'm not a good gamer. I'm not like super skilled. So maybe that's why, because I'm like, I'm just mad that I'm not good. You know, like when people are bad at Overwatch or fucking, you know, any PvP game.
Is that your first Souls game you've played?
Yes.
Well, that makes sense. Maybe
that's the problem, right?
That makes sense. Now, Elden Ring is by far the easiest one of all of them.
What?
By far. I mean, I thought Elden Ring was easy.
Oh my God.
But here's the thing. We both love Zelda, right? Well, I'm not into Breath of the Wild or Tears of the Kingdom. So you can hate Elden Ring and I can hate Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom.
Okay.
Well, I actually haven't played Tears because it just looks like more Breath of the Wild and I'm like not interested. But the reason I bring that up, Zelda games have their own logic. There's a really good podcaster that I've done some episodes with. He's been on mine. His name is Josh. He does a podcast called Still Living Podcast. And we were like both guests on Retro Hangover Podcast talking about, there's this series called King of Games where they pick like 20 games from a year. And then we have like a tournament and everyone argues and we end up naming the king the best game of that year. And yeah. I was in the episode Zelda versus Dune, Zelda Link to the Past versus Dune 2. And you can go listen to it. But the reason I bring this up is Josh made a really good point. He's like, Zelda games, he called it Zelda logic. And if you've never played a Zelda game, it doesn't matter which one you enter on. You can sort of have a similar experience where like, I don't really understand the puzzles. I remember playing Link to the Past. There's the intro where you're in the rain and you're looking for your dad. And then you go to the castle and you have to pick up a bush and there's a hole and you go down the hole into like the dungeon of the castle. And then there's like a pathway that goes right up to the bush. And there's visual cues that you're supposed to pick up, but I didn't even know you could pick up bushes. And I remember as a kid, it took me hours, like 3 to 4 sessions, multiple days, just to get into the intro of that game. And then as I played that game, I started learning like, oh, this is how the puzzles work in this game. This is how the logic works in that game. Then eventually I fell in love with Zelda and Ocarina of Time was a little bit easier for me. The Skyward and then Twilight Princess and so on and so forth. Soulsborne games are the same. So it doesn't matter whether it's Elden Ring or Dark Souls. You are destined for despair to begin with, because it's your first time diving into that genre, and that genre has its own, it's its own genre now. They call it Soulsborne or Souls-like. Yeah. And there's a tough learning curve no matter what. I think Elden Ring is probably it's the easiest because it has the most variation in builds and you can game the system and break the game with builds. And you can make the game really, really easy. But that's assuming you understand how all the mechanics work and the stats work and the scaling. And like, if you don't understand like the difference between strength and dex and how the weapon scaling works and how you can augment weapons and how to gamify your stats, like you literally can't beat that game. You'll just get wrecked.
Yeah, that's what happened to me.
And the game doesn't explain it.
Yeah, no, it does not. It doesn't explain the story either. It's just like, here's a fucking world.
There's the whole world and there's so much lore. And what's interesting about that whole genre of games is they put so much effort into so many things that 90% of players miss, which is good and bad. I had a similar experience. I played Demon's Souls first and gave up. I bought Demon's Souls for PS3 and was like, what the fuck is this shit? This is the most janky bullshit game. I die for like, it makes no sense. I don't know where to go. There's like same thing. Like, I don't want to just get pissed. I want to have fun playing. And so I shelved Demon's Souls and then it like achieved cult status. And then Dark Souls came out and my brother was like, you got to play this game. You got to play this game. And what happened is I started playing Dark Souls and I had friends that were into it and I was able to call them and they could explain, like, the reason this is not working is because you're trying to use this weapon with this scaling and this element and that's not going to work because you, this is how you maximize your scaling and then you have to pick a path and like all the things the game just does not tell you, literally just does not tell you. There's no explanation. And so you should have called me when you started Elden Ring, bro. I would have helped.
That was the problem. I was playing you can kind of play with friends, you know, there's like that weird co-op mode where you can summon people. So occasionally with my brother, we could tackle bigger bosses together and we could kind of figure it out. But it was getting to a point where I was like, I seriously just need this one sword so I could beat this other boss. It was just like I don't even know what it was, the Blood Moon Katana or some shit, so I could do some ultimate bleed build. And I just needed this one sword so I could go and finish the thing that I was doing. I got caught up on just trying to get the sword. So I was getting stuck over and over. And anytime I went anywhere else, I would just get wrecked. And I would end up going back because, like, I just need this fucking sword. Well, I'm just going to try this. So 30 plus times trying to beat the flaming salamander, wherever he fucking lived. It was just like, but I'll hand it to them. Their concept designs, their character designs were incredible.
The open world design,
it was incredible.
I've never enjoyed exploring a map more than that game.
Yeah, it was gorgeous. And the similar to what Breath of the Wild does, where you just randomly stumble into things, like the pot that you pull out of the ground and he's like the pot guy, you know, like the big fucking, like, that's so fucking cool. Like, a lot of that was so fun and it was so Japanese too. That's what I love. The weirdest Japanese. The Japanese are far superior in concept design than Americans are, like, almost indefinitely. They do the coolest shit. But it was just like, it would have been for me an incredible, the perfect game if they just made it a little less hard for me, because I am a casual player. That game wasn't made for me, obviously. No. You know, it was made for gamers. Like,
I'm a casual player too, but I had a support system that helped me get into the genre. And if I wouldn't have had that support system, I would have done, because I did the same thing. I got Demon's Souls and just trashed it. And I was like, I don't understand why this has a cult following. This game is shit.
Yeah.
Right. And it took the pressure from people that I knew were gamers, my brother and some other friends that I respected. And they were like, no, you really need to get through the learning curve and figure this game out. And I did that with Dark Souls 1, and it was a rough, but when it started clicking, it is now my favorite genre of game. Like, I took time off of work and prepped my wife and was like, she knows now, like, when a new FromSoft game comes out, like, I'm going to that and Final Fantasy, because Final Fantasy is coming out on the 22nd and I'm going to dis-a-fucking-peer.
Oh yeah.
100%.
Yeah. So I played Final Fantasy online last year with my brother, and we were just doing, like, you know, it's all mostly PvE campaign stuff, but I've never played a Final Fantasy game before, but I've been so aware of it, and I've seen my friends play. I've watched hours of it, of like my friends playing, of us just like drinking and watching my friend play Final Fantasy X or something. like that's, it's super entertaining, and I get the whole genre. I think it's great. But I jumped right into the online, I don't even know what that one's called, 14 online, or just Final Fantasy Online, or
they
something.
They came out with, well, they had a really bad launch, then they like destroyed the whole world and then rebranded it as,
yeah.
And they've come out with like 6 or 7 expansions that all have their own sub name.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's up to. That's the only Final Fantasy I've never played. Well, there's two onlines. Final Fantasy 11 that was on the PS2 was the first online one. And then I think it's 14.
Yeah. That's the one I played.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one was fun. The characters are fun. It just felt like a knockoff World of Warcraft, because I grew up on that one. And personally for me, I think World of Warcraft has nailed MMOs. Like, they kind of set the genre for MMOs. Like,
there was EverQuest before, but
yeah, MMOs, I played that too.
MMOs became like a mainstream genre with World of Warcraft.
Yeah,
that's when MMOs, I feel like, broke through and became much more mainstream. Is that game?
Yeah, so Final Fantasy was cool. I loved the characters. I loved the music. Like, it was fun to play. Eventually, it just got, like, just like World of Warcraft, it just got super repetitive. So I stopped playing that. And then my brother and I jumped back into World of Warcraft in 2021, we played Shadowlands. We played that for like a month and a half, 2 months, or maybe even longer than that. And I had previously never done PvP in World of Warcraft, but that's all my brother wants to do. So we just did that, and that was super fun. We took a break from that, and then Dragonflight came out. We played just as of like a month ago, we stopped playing that, but we played the whole probably 4 months and just got really heavy into PvP. And that was like, man, some of the most complicated fucking PvP you've ever played is World of Warcraft, with all of the different numbers and abilities and so many different characters you have to know. Just like, it's so much more complicated than just like an FPS. Yeah. Like, just like you run with like, you just change guns and you shoot slightly differently. Like, every match was different. The difficulty was super high. And then that kind of fell off. And then Tears of the Kingdom came out and I almost cried when I downloaded it. We've talked about this so many times. I have a Zelda tattoo. I've loved it since Ocarina of Time. I wouldn't say that I'm a diehard fan, but every time I play it, I get emotional. When it first comes out, I get really emotional. I get so excited. And my girlfriend was like watching me like transform into this fucking nerd as it gets closer and closer to the release date. And I'm like whistling Zelda tunes. And she's like, what are you fucking doing? Tears of the Kingdom. So Breath of the Wild is the beta for Tears of the Kingdom, hands down. Like,
yeah,
the first experiment in open world for the Zelda franchise was Breath of the Wild, and they nailed it. And it was like, I would say like 9 out of 10, 8 out of 10, such a fun game. And Tears of the Kingdom, they have just blown out of the water. Breath of the Wild should just never be played by anybody. You should just look at YouTube videos for the story and then jump straight into Tears of the Kingdom. It's incredible. It's about twice the size of the last game. So it's just this massive open world, and there's so many side quests, and the designs are incredible, and the music is beautiful, and you just like walking out of a shrine and the sun is setting, and just fucking gorgeous. And it's granted, it's an easy game. It can be hard sometimes. Like, there's some bosses that are like, oh, this is kind of tricky. But if you compare that to like Dark Souls or Elden Ring, it's like, it's not hard at all. They kind of hold your hand. So it's an easy game, which makes it accessible, which makes it very popular for everybody, and almost no bugs at all. Like, talk about a AAA title. In the era of AAA titles launching and being total shit, Tears of the Kingdom was the smoothest, just like, here's your game. And it was just magic dust being spread across the planet, and everybody's just like doe-eyed and fucking having so much fun. Like, that's a real game experience when it's hyped up and it sounds amazing, and then it comes out and then it is amazing, and then it's just like, it's just fucking great. And then they have this like building element where you can like make vehicles, and you can like craft things with power sources, and they've got wheels, and you've got fans, and you've got gliders with like rocket launchers. So you can make like fucking tanks. You just have materials, and it's like a sandbox game. You can just make a vehicle out of all the materials that they give you. So that's the newest thing that's making it super fun. People are making like, they're making like,
I've seen fucking, some crazy shit online.
Yeah. It's like a big plank standing straight up, and he's got a dick.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They shoot an arrow at it, and it just shoots fire.
I've seen that one. I've seen people like torturing Koroks.
Yeah. Just launching them into space.
Yeah.
they're like committing war crimes. I've seen some that are being crucified and then lit on fire and then launched into the air with a rocket. Just like,
yeah. I'm going to probably. So I tried Breath of the Wild, and I got maybe like 15 hours into it, and it just didn't stick for me.
Really?
With open world games, I get open world fatigue. So if I get into an open world game, I usually can't play another one for a year, even if there's other good ones. And I had played, around the same time with Breath of the Wild, there were some other games. I got pretty far into Assassin's Creed Origins. I did a lot of the spectator mode and like the Egypt history stuff. They have like a whole like side game where you can just like take tours of things they've recreated. Wow. But I put like 60 hours into Origins. Ghost of Tsushima is a great open world game. I played that. Yeah. Horizon, the first one. I played a lot of open world games. And I think when I got to Breath of the Wild, I was just burned out. I'm like, another open world game. That's just, I don't have time. I wanted to, then I moved. I think I played Oh, Last of Us Part Two, which is like the
Yeah.
opposite. It's like an on-rails cinematic. You just follow the story. There's no really exploration. There's a couple areas in that game that are sort of semi-open world. But I've been watching Tears of the Kingdom, and the emulation scene has gotten way better. Switch emulation is amazing.
Yeah.
And I know there's it can already run at 4K 60 FPS or some cool mods. I'm going to wait for like a year when there's like a really good set of mods. Because you can run Breath of the Wild with RTX lighting and texture mods and all this stuff. That's all going to happen to Tears of the Kingdom eventually, like
Oh,
within a
shit.
year. And I'll probably play it when all the bells and whistles have come out for emulation, and
Yeah.
because I'm way into mods. Like
Yeah.
that's I spend more time tinkering with mods. Like I just played through Final Fantasy X, and I probably spent just as much time modding it as I did beating the game and getting it set up the way that I think would be the coolest way to play it. Texture
Right.
mods, FPS mods, music mods, FMV upscales, like everything you can get. I'm doing 12 Final Fantasy 12 right now. And so I am jonesing. I'm seeing what they're doing with Tears of the Kingdom right now. I'm like, okay, everyone loves that game. Like it's unanimously
Yeah.
being held across the gaming fandom of the internet as like it's the bomb.
Yeah.
Friends, every friend I know that's played it loves it. So I am going to play that game. But I did Elden Ring. I mean, I put 140 hours into Elden Ring. So it's like
Yeah.
after Elden Ring, I remember telling my brother, like, I can't. I'm glad they don't have a DLC yet. Like, I can't. I'm done. Like, I need a
Yeah.
year. I need a year break from anything open world. It's just, like you said, it's too much of a commitment. And I play games semi-regularly, but 99% of the time I'm playing a game, I'm doing it to make content, to do like
Right.
stuff for social media, to promote the podcast. I'm doing like social media, and like my TikTok has done fairly well, and I'm making these like 15-minute clips. So like I just played through the Lies of P demo, which is a Bloodborne type of kind of copy, but you play Pinocchio and it's all gothic and it's really, really awesome. I
That's
want to
sick.
play it, but I'm also like playing it so that I can do a review of the demo and put it up on YouTube. And so it's hard for me sometimes to be like, I don't want to make Tears of the Kingdom content because there's a million people out there. There's already so much good content.
Right.
So it's like when I have time to play a game, I usually like it has to be a game that I want to play and make sense to do content for.
Right.
Whereas Tears of the Kingdom, like I didn't make any Elden Ring content, but I had to set aside time. Like I'm playing games with there is no purpose to grow the podcast. This is just
Right.
me enjoying a game to enjoy the game. So Tears of the Kingdom will happen at some point, and I'll probably mod the shit out of it and get through it, but it will be, I can't do it because Final Fantasy 16 comes out in a week.
Yeah, how's that one looking?
Similar to what you said about Tears of the Kingdom. The rumor about 16 is that it's been done for a year and a half and they've been doing nothing but polishing it. And it's going to come out bug free and just ready to go. I think there's been so much shit, like you said, with AAA games and bad launches. I think the industry is realizing that we can't do that. It's
You
better just to
can't,
wait a
dude.
year. It's better. I mean, Cyberpunk was a game that I was so pumped for and the
Yeah.
launch was so bad. Now they have eventually patched it and it's sold. They made a lot of money. It's still selling copies. Phantom Liberty or Phantom, whatever it's called, the DLC is coming out. But the game would have been bigger and they would have made
Yeah.
more money had they just put it out a year later.
Yeah. I played it a year after it came out because I was super pumped for it to come out, and then it just got the worst reviews. So I waited. It was on discount for 50%, and they'd fixed all the bugs. So I downloaded it, played it with no bugs, and it was real smooth. And I was like, this is a fucking
It's a great
amazing
game.
game. It was
Yeah.
so fun. So fun. I just played, dude, I played fucking probably 50 to 60 hours just like on side quests. Like I was just fucking around forever. It was so fun. Yeah, so many fucking, even like games that I didn't know were coming out, like AAA titles that were coming out. And then all of a sudden I'm seeing like YouTube videos of these bad reviews. I'm like, I didn't even know this piece of shit was coming out good because I didn't, because it was like one of the worst launches. What was it? Forspoken or Forsaken?
Forspoken. I was
Yeah.
amped for that game because it was the first time that magic looked cool as fuck.
Yeah. And
Yeah.
then similar, like Harry Potter, Hogwarts Legacy came out. It didn't have a lot of bugs, but it was just so overhyped. It was not as, I didn't even finish. Like I probably played 10 to 15 hours, and it's an open world game. And I was just like, I'm fucking bored, dude. Like,
That's what's weird. I had to say. I loved it for the first like 15 hours.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I just lost all motivation for it.
Yeah. The magic of like going through the school and like picking your character. I was like, oh, it's so like my childhood was coming back. And I was like, oh, this is so fun. And then I started playing the game.
Hogwarts.
And,
like you are in the school.
Oh, fucking but for sure.
I think my gripe with that is it's so slow.
Yep.
Slow to get spells. And it was just like too tedious. And so I started looking like, I looked into a save editor. I'm like, I don't have time. I just want to like get the cool shit because I don't want to spend 100 hours playing this game. So I ended up like finding a save editor on PC and like getting a bunch of the spells and like giving myself money. And then I made it a little bit farther and I was going full dark path. I'm like, I'm going full Voldemort, baby. Full curse.
Me too.
Even that, like it just didn't – I don't know. I ended up spending more time. I got a camera hack. I've been playing around with doing – there's a like in-game cinematography where you can get hacks and you can detach the camera and then you can make like shot – like cinematic shots of the game. I put out a video called The Beauty of Hogwarts Legacy, and it's just a compilation of all the shots that I pulled while I was playing through the game.
Yeah.
But the video only goes through the first 20% of the game because I quit. I was just like, I'm not going to beat it. So I'm just going to put out what I have.
Yeah.
That was a weird game because the hype was real in the beginning. Like I was so amped and I had such a, I was legitimately enjoying it for like 10 hours, loved it. And then something happened where it just lost me.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wasn't convinced anymore. You know, like the magic of the initial 20 hours died off. And then I was like, oh, I know what this whole game is already. I know that I'm going to repeat this thing 20, 50 times until the game is over. I kind of know what the storyline is already. I don't really need to like go through all this stuff. Okay, I get it. You know, there was no surprise anymore.
Yeah.
Like, it was just cool visually, cool like mood-wise. And then it was just like gameplay, you just lost me there.
I think the environment design, though.
It was incredible.
The environment design was so good. I thought the character was a little janky, like the people, but I loved the environment design.
Yeah. 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 The building design, like Hogwarts inside was gorgeous. The places you would go to were gorgeous. So I was playing on my PC and I didn't have a controller. So I was playing on my keyboard. The fucking broom mechanics on a keyboard are
Shit. They're not great on the controller.
I don't, maybe it's like the triggers when you're like going up and down. Like, I don't know what changes your elevation, but on the keyboard, it was like control and like space bar. So you're doing this like weird, like pinky thing to go up and then you have to like WSD to move like in your arrows. So it was just like the mechanics were fucking trash for the broom. And I was like, I hope they don't make a Quidditch game because this is going to be so trash. Lo and behold, they announced like some Quidditch game coming out. Yeah, they kind of like, I don't know if they announced an official date, but they mentioned that there is a Quidditch game coming.
Mm.
So that'll be, you know.
I had this basically the same experience. I loved it in the beginning, lost. It's not that I hated it. I didn't like it enough to finish it.
Right. Yeah. And that's disappointing.
Again, open world games. It's just, it has to be really, really good for me to commit the time.
Right. Yeah. That when Breath of the Wild came out, I played it every day for couple hours. And then on weekends, I'd be like, oh, I'm sick. I can't go out. And I'd just play Breath of the Wild for 10 hours in a day. And then I played for the first 3 weeks of the launch. And then I took a break because Diablo 4 came out last week.
I haven't played it yet.
Diablo 4, yeah. No bugs at all. No performance issues. Like, just smooth as could be. I experience lag issues more than I do performance issues. I think it's all been lag so far, and it's actually kind of fun, and I had pretty low expectations of it going in, but I can already see once I'm done with the campaign, that's probably going to be it for me, because I know there's going to be like, there's like world events and world bosses like they do in WoW, and there's a huge MMO element to it now, because you see players all over the place.
Yeah.
But if you're in a group and you go into a dungeon, it's like your own solo instance, like you don't see anybody else. It's been pretty fun. It's fucking crazy complicated. And again, it's a huge open world map. So it's like, I looked at the map today as I was playing and I was like, oh my God, I hope the campaign just steers me through all this. Cause I don't want to do the legwork of just walking around like I do in Breath of the Wild, you know?
I'm very, you're probably the same way, even though I'm not an artist. Art direction and aesthetic is,
can it's everything. Be,
it's everything to me. Like, it, there's a lot of games that are mechanically great games that I cannot get over the art direction. And so I can't enjoy them. Yeah. And I'm the opposite of you. I'm not, sometimes you were talking about the 64 is in the art direction, and then you mentioned Crash Bandicoot and you, and the Zeldas, and that more maybe cartoonish or anime like direction of art direction.
Illustrated, yeah.
And as I've gotten older, probably because I've gotten into like heavier music, I like more gritty art direction for the most part. Sometimes I can get into like stylish anime stuff if it's done correctly. The reason I was excited for Diablo 4 is they're going back to the Diablo 2.
Oh, yeah.
More like dark, gothic, bloody. And so for me, the art direction of Diablo 4 looks very, very sexy.
Dude, some of the level designs, like traditionally Diablo games have been a top-down view, a fixed camera view, bird's eye, and it just follows your character as you move around. And the maps just kind of slowly revealed themselves outside of your field of view. It was just kind of foggy.
Yeah.
When you're in a dungeon in this fucking game, there's like a cavern down below, like not even where it matters. There is some insane detail, like the mood and the environment of every dungeon and the roads themselves and the monsters are incredible. Like there's this one dungeon that had like huge organs and veins going up the wall. But as you're moving around, they're like pulsing and shaking, and like these long spindly fingers are like just it's so fucking creepy. It's like so old school Diablo.
Yeah.
They really did not spare the detail, and the reflections on the ground are insane. Like, not even, I have a 1660 Super in my computer, just super basic graphics card, and this game looks incredible on my PC.
What resolution are you running?
Fucking, I don't even know, dude. I don't even know what it's set at. Just the default that it comes in. I don't change any of the settings or graphics, because I know my little 1660 doesn't handle much, so I open the game and play it. I don't get super deep into that.
The art direction looks amazing on that. I've only really played Diablo 2. I haven't played 3 or 1. 3, I got 3 for the Switch, actually, when it came out. I'm like, this would be a great game for the Switch, but I didn't like how cartoony it was.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's such a shallow thing. Some of the reasons I don't like some Final Fantasies, like Final Fantasy X, I just replayed through. For the podcast, I'm doing some videos on it. Spoiler alert, like I loved the game and the world and the lore, and the art direction does not match the world and the lore to me. And the whole time I was playing it, like if I wasn't playing this for podcast content, I would have bailed, because there's so much friction with in the art direction to me.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that I've never gotten. Like a lot of people say that's such a shallow, I mean, it is, especially if a game is really, really good. But I grew up in an era where like one of the most exciting things about a new game or a new console was the upgrade in graphics. Like, I don't know, that was a big motivating factor, and it's hard for me to get into something if I don't like the art direction.
Right.
It's very hard.
Yeah, Diablo 4 does not lack any of that. So I've been playing with my friend Justin, and we'll go through an instance and he'll be like, his character will be off the fucking map somewhere. I'm like, bro, what are you doing? He's like, come check out this like tile mosaic on the floor over here in the corner, and we'll go to like the darkest parts of the corner of this dungeon, and there's like this beautiful gilded mosaic of some demons fighting some angels on the floor underneath like some dust, and we're just like, we'll spend a couple minutes like moving our character around because you the
check
little
it
light.
Out yeah
and we'll just spend like in the corners, things that you wouldn't even see in the game, because he's an artist too, so him and I are just gushing over the visuals of this game. And the design, he bought the deluxe version of the art book, and it came with like the rose petals that Lilith leaves everywhere in the game inside of the case. So you open it up and there's like all this like art from the game, and it's just like the Diablo art books. If anybody hasn't seen them, if any of you guys are listening and are curious about art books, any Diablo art book, I think the Book of Lorath is their, the one that came out like 5-6 years ago, the new one recently, like some of the most incredible art books around. Just like the creature design, the monster design, the way that it's designed in general was a huge inspiration for how my book is being laid out and how we did the graphic design. We liked the antiqued pages. We were going to do some sketches inside like they do with the art books. But again, Diablo, the last couple games weren't that great, but man, that their art style is so consistently fucking so good.
It's what is so your good. Favorite game of all time in terms of art direction?
Boy, because I'm so partial and grew up with the Link franchise, Legend of Zelda, I should say, franchise, I'm just particularly fond. I would say that it's good. It's probably not the best art direction. I'm going to reach out on a limb, even though I hate Elden Ring. I think Elden Ring has some of the best concept design I've ever seen in a game. The new Diablo is just so a close second. Genuinely, I'm not saying this because I'm like stuck up about my art, or I'm like, you know, one of those fucking French artists that he puts on the little and then sits to coffee. Yeah. Fucking critique. But I have very high standards when it comes to visuals. Like when I generally see a game, I'm like, yeah, that fits. That's like, they did a good job with like the overall feel of whatever game, Fire Emblem or whatever. Like, so most games don't really blow me away. It really takes a lot. Like a lot to get me impressed. And Elden Ring was incredible. That's why I started playing it in the first place, mostly because of that. And Diablo 4 took me by surprise for sure. Breath of the Wild, like in game, is gorgeous. But it's actually the Tears of the Kingdom used a lot of Mayan design, architectural design, and creature design and weapon design. They killed it with those Mayan concepts mixed with like, they take like Mayan concepts and they mix some clothing design with like Greek fashion with just like togas and leather strapped sandals and just like such a weird combo of art styles that they really strung together and made it like pretty unique. And the story is great too. So I'm going to say, I guess those three games right there have been really stand out to me, but I think I'm kind of like you and I'm starting to get more into, I'm starting to really appreciate dark art a little bit, and not in the sense like cult stuff, like you were sacrificing goats, but I really appreciate how dark and like muted color palettes and just things are like sharp and pointy and aggressive. I don't know. I think I'm just like, I think when you get into your 30s, maybe it's just me, but you kind of just like see the same things repeating themselves over and over. Mm-hmm. And when you see a unique game come out, like Elden Ring really mixing up a style, or Tears of the Kingdom doing something really fresh, you're just like, fuck, that's so good. You know, it just takes a lot now, is what I'm saying. And yeah. I think those three games have been killing it. I don't know. What about you? What are your thoughts?
I would agree. Well, I haven't played Tears of the Kingdom, but I have seen enough footage where I see what you're talking about. You nailed it. Mayan and Greek clothing. I can see both of those. Diablo 4, again, I haven't played, but I'm interested because of the art style, and I've watched a fair amount of footage on YouTube. Felt the same way. Like, I'm into dark stuff, but so this goes back to, I didn't want to interrupt you when you were talking about like the story leading into the Kickstarter and the book, but there's some overlap with your journey as an artist and my journey as a musician. We've almost, I don't know if you would say creepy or synchronistic, about we've had a very similar path.
Yeah.
When we met, I was just starting to get into like a really heavy party and addiction phase.
Yeah.
I was living with some buddies in a house where my buddy Todd, and then I sold alarms and made some decent money. And then for the next 2 years, I basically rented a house for 2 years up front with the money and then just sub rented the rooms out. And so I ended up getting my cost of living pretty low, and I had a big chunk of change, and I partied and did like nothing with my life for 2 years because I didn't, yeah. I was lost. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to do music. I started a record label, and like with the tattoo thing, the record label and my first musical solo, I did bands, but then I did a solo production for 7 years, and I was doing it full time, and I was breaking through and getting some gigs and doing small tours with bigger artists, but I didn't believe I could make it. Oh, that's what it comes down to. I wasn't like you where I had this confidence. In the back of my mind, it was like, I don't have what it takes, even though I'm getting somewhere, and the money wasn't good enough, but I needed to spend time. And so I bailed. And like that tattoo failure, the failure of the record label and the failure of my first production alias and leaving that all behind, it was like really rough. It took me years. It was kind of in the background, but it took years to sort of process that. And I basically told myself I'm done with music. I just got to find a way to make money and just I'll make music for me on the side. Right. But like I basically gave up on my dreams, but I got really, I was into electronic music and then I started getting back into rock and metal and progressive metal, which yeah. has like darker branding and darker aesthetic.
For sure.
And then I started the same thing. I started developing like, okay, I like some of it, but I'm not into like overt, like goth. Like I don't think Ozzy Osbourne or Alice in Chains or like that's not yeah. cool. But I would run across like what I would call elegant dark aesthetic. And the game that comes to mind would be a game called Control. It was game of the year in like 2017. It is not a perfect game by any means. The game might be a little rough for your graphics card. So I don't know how well it's going to perform for you. It's not the most technically optimized game. It's not a perfect game, but the art direction in this game, it mixes like brutalism, like Soviet architecture.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
The story is paranormal and gods and consciousness and the collective consciousness manifesting into reality. And there's like this idea that there's a secret government agency called the Federal Bureau of Control that investigates what they call AWEs or altered world events when sort of the paranormal breaks through. Anyway, the art direction in that game is dark, but it's like really classy.
Yeah, it looks
like
great,
it's not like goth, like, oh, we're sacrificing goats and there's blood, like Slipknot. People love Slipknot. I cannot get into that. Not for me.
No.
And so I discovered like there's this little sub niche in dark art direction where they mix like minimalism and elegance, but it's dark and mystical.
Yeah.
And that's what I got into. And then I ended up doing a music project that I started a year ago like with my brother. And it's been going really, really well. Like it's going to happen. Like we're growing fast. And it's interesting when you were talking about gods and goddesses, because of my whole interest in leaving Mormonism. And then I got into these mythology, but the subset of mythology would be these esoteric occult philosophies that have kind of been running under the scene of all major world religions. And it's this idea that there is something more and that maybe Zeus wasn't the way on the surface it's portrayed, but there's archetypes and there is some sort of reality to these spiritual phenomena. And maybe that does tie into UFOs going all the way back to the beginning of our conversation. So I developed a brand that's all built around, I'm building my own fan fiction based on esoteric religions. Look, I'm taking things that I sort of believe, and taking things that I don't believe that I think are cool from different traditions and kind of putting them together. And there's underneath the music and the music videos, there is like a doctrine or a belief system. And I think people resonate, even though it's all abstract. I make these music videos that are all, they're very abstract. But when I make them, there is a message. Every shot is thought out and other people might interpret them different. But I think people can sense that there is, it has been thought out and there is an underlying meaning, even if they don't pull it. And it's, I just thought it was interesting. You're doing this Kickstarter and this art book, which is similar themed gods and goddesses and ancient whatever. And I'm doing a music project that's on the cert, like it, zoomed out. It's really the same theme. The details are different, but it's the same theme. It's like exploring the idea of gods. And I do believe that there is some sort of non-human intelligence. They call her the lady. Some religions call her Fatima. Some people call her Mary Magdalene. People have the gentleman I mentioned earlier, Chris Bledsoe, has had an experience with her. And so I've done all this artwork. I'm obsessed with, she's like a goddess basically. And I think there is actually something to this idea of this particular goddess.
It's funny that you say that, because this is insane. I took this, so I took DMT, I want to say a year ago for the first time, right? And I had it in a vape pen with my buddy, and he's like, just take six big rips and then hold the last one in.
Six is a big, that's
dude. I take six full lung, and then the last one I held it in, immediately blacked out, fell backwards, and just started like groaning, like, oh, like rubbing my butt. And there was like shamanic music playing in the background. He just knew how to set up the whole vibe for me.
Yeah.
So, and this is my buddy Trevor. Shout out to my boy Trevor. And I legitimately was teleported to another dimension, universe. I don't know what to call it. This sounds insane because it's a drug induced high, but if you've ever taken DMT, it's real. It feels yeah. so real. And I was teleported first to this like waiting room, I think people call it, where it looked like a black apple core. This room was like, imagine an apple core, and lights were coming above the ceiling, coming down to the core of the apple and pulsing. And then I just saw repeated pulses of lights going through this apple core. And then I was teleported to like, it literally felt like Egypt, because there was a pyramid in the background. There was palm trees in the foreground to my left, and right above the pyramid, there was a prism of light in the sky where everything met to a point. And in the middle of that point was kind of like the body of the goddess. And she had 1,000 blue arms, no full body, just arms coming from the prism of light at the peak. And these 1,000 blue arms coming down and like tickling my body. And I could feel this like tickling sensation. And she was like welcoming me to this place that she lived. And it was like the most warm, pleasant feeling ever. And I remember just being like welcomed, and she's like tickling me, but like it felt more like soul touching strokes that just warmed me up and made me feel so calm. And I was just like in total ecstasy. And then I was like, it felt like forever. And then all of a sudden I wake up and I'm not high. There's no hangover. I'm calm. And I just sit up and I look at my friend and said, I just met a goddess. He's like, yeah, you fucking did. And then we hugged, and I was like so calm. And it was like one of the greatest experiences. But it's funny that you say that there is this goddess. I feel like I met her. And this is going to sound insane. My girlfriend's going to make fun of me after this. I'm like, yeah, you're so done, because she's never done a drug in her life. But dude, I met the goddess that you're talking about. It's insane.
And what's interesting is, I think circling back to the UFO thing, there's all these people that have had experience. We call them experiencers. And they usually get mocked, right? You're crazy. You're lying, whatever. A subset of those experiencers, or you could even say they weren't UFO, maybe high strangeness or anomalous experiences. People have experiences with a goddess. Like, this is a motif that's been happening. And depending on the culture and the time when the human has this experience, maybe they say it's Mary Magdalene, or maybe they say it's Fatima, or maybe they say it's Hathor, or whoever. Right. This gentleman, Chris Bledsoe, again, his son has a podcast. I'm in the private Discord. I've had chats with him. I've had some interactions with his little sister. Like, this family has had the experiences they've had. They're telling the truth. And people meet this goddess not on drugs, right? I think there's more than one way to skin a cat. I think you could probably do breathing exercises and get yourself into an altered state of consciousness.
Right.
I met a female being on DMT as well, but and she also had many arms, but she had like an insect face. Mm. And it wasn't this loving. I'd done DMT like 5-6 times. And the very last time, I was sort of jealous that I hadn't had the breakthrough experiences that other people had.
Yeah.
So I went into it, and anyone who's done psychedelics, set and setting are a big deal.
Yep.
I didn't have a shaman. I didn't have music. I went into it jealous that my brother had this breakthrough experience. And I had also had 2 glasses of wine, which is like a little bit of a depressant. You should not mix alcohol and psychedelics.
No.
And I went into it like, I'm going to fucking just rip this thing until I can't rip it. And I'm like, because I was thinking like, maybe I just haven't taken enough. But I went into it out of jealousy. And anyone who's done psychedelics, if you can't let go and just let the experience happen, you're going to have a bad time. And I know this. I've had really wild LSD experiences where, but I was in a good space, so I could let go, and they were not fearful or anxious. But with this DMT experience, I ripped it over and over. Same thing in vape pen. I don't even know how many times. I just was like, I'm going to rip it until I can't rip it, because I'm taken off, right? I can't physically rip it anymore. Just get over your fear. Don't be a pussy. Just
You've got Joe Rogan playing in the background loud as fuck. You're just like,
yeah. <"Ooh." laughs> And then something put its hand on my shoulder and said, that's enough.
Oof.
And so I put it down. But I was, and if you've done psychedelics, you, whether it's mushrooms or DMT or LSD, you can, as you're taking off, you can get a sense of how much fuel is in the rocket, so to speak. Like, yeah. You can tell how gnarly it's going to be on the come up. And as soon as I put it down, I could feel, I was like, holy shit, dude. It's too late. I've already done it. And you get about, it's fast. You only get about 15 to 30 seconds before you're off, right?
Yeah, dude.
And I laid back. I was in this chair in this office. I laid back and I said out loud, like, this is what you wanted. Prepare yourself to accept, right? I knew. I started saying, I accept.
That's so terrifying.
And I went, the first part was cool. Because I finally went to what Alex Gray has been painting for 20 years. I saw, like, I'm like, I get it. I went to the room, many faces, like
the same.
I'm in an Alex Gray painting.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is cool, but I just kept going farther and farther and farther.
I know.
And eventually I broke through to this insect head, multi-armed female light being. And like you said, the soul, like it started working on my soul. And but I don't think I was in a good place. Like, you were able to accept it and it was enjoyable.
Yeah.
I was in a dark place and it felt like my soul was a Rubik's cube and she was trying to like solve it, like get me through whatever I was trying to, but I couldn't. And I started having a conversation with this being and I was like, you got to slow down. This is too emotionally painful. Like, slow down, help me. I started calling out to like, any spirit guide and like someone come and help me because I can't.
Holy shit!
I can't let go. And it she would like pull back and like cock her head, and then like go back to work. And it was like, my job is to get you to the other side and to like get you sorted out.
Yeah.
And it was like she was trying to get me through the other side, but I couldn't let go. So I had a rocket ship of DMT fuel, but I couldn't let go. So I was just getting like slammed into the wall, and eventually. Like, she put me down, and like, if you've ever communicated with a being on a psychedelic, they speak to you almost like telepathically.
Right.
She didn't speak with her words, but I knew what she was saying, and she just said malleable. And it was like, I knew what she meant, come back when you're malleable, which come back when you're ready.
Yeah.
And then I came down and I like broke down and I was just like weeping. It was, yesterday was the first time I've done a psychedelic since then because I was like, I was told, don't come back till you're ready.
Yeah.
I took a gram of mushrooms yesterday and went on a ride. And a gram's not enough to like.
No, you just get a little tipsy
Just get a little tipsy, but I just sort of like, okay, I want to get back into it. And I am going to do another big DMT trip and hopefully I'll be ready. But I'm going to fast. I did a really heavy LSD trip and I fasted for 6 days. I didn't plan it. I was just into fasting because of gut issues and I'm curious about fasting.
Yeah.
Deep fasting, which I highly recommend to anyone. It's not, you're not going to starve to death. I promise you. But I was 6 days into the fast and my family ended up impromptu going out of town when I was home alone. And I had these two tabs in my drawer for like a year, just waiting for the day, the right day to take them. And I'm like, I was in a good mood. I'm like, okay, pop the two tabs. And I was, Jesus. Same thing. I was completely gone. When I peaked, Mount Timpanogos was flopping like a accordion. The whole mountain was and everything melted around me, and I ended up seeing a spider god. And I don't want to, I've already talked about this on the podcast, but long story short, I had just as much of a breakthrough experience, but it was positive. I had no, because I was able to just let go and accept the experience and accept what was happening. And so I think those beings that you encounter either in a deep meditation or a breathing state or a psychedelic state, sometimes it just happens to people. They just have experiences that come out of nowhere. These altered state of consciousnesses, I don't think they might just be in your head, but in your head might be as real as this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I've had experiences astral traveling totally sober. Like you can listen to the binaural beats. You can go through the Monroe Instant Gateway program. You can follow the meditation and you will leave your body stone cold sober. I don't know if it's like you're actually leaving body or you're going in your own brain, but what I do know is you can have the experience. You can follow a protocol. The protocol will say, this is what's going to happen. And exactly what they say is going to happen happens. And you have these wild experiences. And I think there's something to them. I think there's a reason why people like you and me get obsessed with these ideas of spirituality and gods and goddesses. I think there's a shift going on. And I think that this world speaks to humanity through creative people. Because I had an experience, one of the songs I wrote for this new music project. I don't know if you've had this doing art. Actually, I know you probably have been in a deep flow space where it's like you sit down and you start painting, maybe some music's going, and all of a sudden 6 hours go by and you can't remember because you're just like in that creative flow space. And oh, there's a feeling. I had a song that family was out of town, right? Coincidences, I had like 3 days, 4 days to focus on music. I remember starting the song and I remember a few little snapshots of like memories, but I don't remember almost the whole week. And at the end of the week, there's a song and like a piece of my soul got like translated into that song.
Right.
It's a really weird experience. And so, it sounds crazy to people, but I'm like, it's not crazy, especially when you've experienced it. There is something going on.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it happens to me pretty regularly where I'm so used to it. It used to take me a long time to get into the mood to paint. Like I really had to push myself. After a decade plus, it's easy for me to just jump into a painting and just start working because I know what the plan is, you know, all the mystery is gone. And then it's just, I'm just rendering. I'm just like noodling away, doing details. And I'll have podcasts in the background. I'll have music playing, whatever. Hours go by very easily. And it's interesting because every artwork is just a visual interpretation of an idea that's in our heads. It's we're taking something intangible and making it tangible that other people can experience and digest in a specific way, whether that's music or whether that's art or poetry or whatever. So anytime you're working on a piece of music or I'm playing drums to a new song or I'm making a painting, it's literally what is inside of you. If you really want to get to know an artist in some way, look at their portfolio, look at their music, what kind they make, and you can derive from that what kind of person they are. If you can really get their whole portfolio. I mean, you look at all my stuff, there's a lot of gods and goddesses with multiple arms, and then there's fantasy landscapes, and then I've been doing a bunch of animals recently, and it's just, you can kind of just tell what's going on in their head, what they care about, what they feel about. Multi-armed goddess are just a plentiful when you start taking psychedelics and mythology and ancient worlds and then UFOs. You're like, oh shit, this is so cool.
I'm really bullish that this UFO thing is becoming mainstream because I suspect it's more, like I mentioned earlier, it's more than just some biological entity from another planet. I think it's even weirder than that. I think there's dimensions and different realities and energies. I think it's more than just an alien. And I think this is the start of maybe society opening up to new ideas, because first it's like, you can just accept there's a non-human intelligence out there. Well, maybe there's spirits out there. Maybe all these people that have paranormal experience, like my mom, people I train with, good friends, have had really wild experiences. I know they're not lying. In fact, they're very hesitant to tell people because they're worried about being judged. They're worried about being made fun of. But these are experiences that they've had. I know they're not lying. Now, their interpretation of the experience may be wrong or right. Just like we were saying with Zeus and lightning. Someone sees a lightning like, dude, I think it's Zeus, right? They did see lightning. The phenomena is real. Now, maybe their story they tell themselves about the phenomena may or may not be real, but they had the experience. They said they had, and I think that's undeniable. So you have UFO experiencers, abductees, paranormal, psychic, like all these phenomena are going on. And sure, some of it is crazy people with mental illness. Some of it is people who are lying, but not all of it. And there's so many experiences out there. There's so many humans having mystical spiritual experiences, having paranormal experiences, having UFO experiences, seeing orbs, seeing craft, seeing lights, seeing gods and goddesses. Like, there's more. Back to the scientific method has got us really far, but it hasn't discovered everything. We didn't know what radiation was for a long time. Our senses can't sense it. But eventually we developed the technology that can sense waves, electromagnetic waves or radiation, these things that we would have never known, even just radio waves, fucking Wi-Fi, whatever. All those things were invisible and not real, but they exist. Maybe we invent technology and we realize that, like, oh, spiritual phenomena is some mixture of quantum physics, gravity, and electromagnetism that maybe it's purely natural and there is no intelligence behind it, or maybe consciousness can be embodied in things besides animals and people. Maybe it can be embodied in some sort of energy. Like, I don't know, but what I do think is we're going to eventually figure it out. And I do think religion and myth and science, in a perfect world, if we keep using the scientific method the right way, not the money scientific method, but the actual discipline of hypothesis, test, observation, do over and over again, eventually we're going to figure out what all these phenomena are. Yeah. And then they won't be a phenomena anymore. They'll have an explanation.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder, I mean, there's got to be a million reasons why they don't release the information about the aliens and the crafts. I mean, obviously we live in a capitalist society that the existence of aliens doesn't feel like it supports capitalism very well. Like, the idea that there are planetary beings kind of crumbles our society a little bit, and it breaks the trust of the U.S. government. Or, I mean, there's got to be so many different reasons, but when you get into metaphysics and psychedelics, or even just yoga and meditation, you start believing that there's something else, and this narrative that we've been sold, that thin veil gets shattered a little bit with those practices. And it's really interesting to see how this will play out. I don't know how society would handle a full blown, like, yeah, aliens exist. Here are some photos. Here's some craft.
I used to think that would be a big deal, but the government's like, we have 12 craft.
Yeah.
Look around and, like, no one gives a, because I have a couple in my work group, some employees and some outsourcers I work with. And they've, one of them literally said, like, I don't care if there's aliens or not. Like, I don't give a fuck. And that just blows my mind. Like, what do you mean? It's like, it doesn't matter to me. I think that was probably, I wonder if all the sci-fi and the pop culture and the movies and the comic books, I mean, comic books have been delving into multiple timelines and dimensions. I just saw Across the Spider-Verse or Beyond whatever it's called today, which is fucking awesome, by the way, if you haven't seen it.
The art is
The way they made that movie, someone by hand going through and painting over every frame, 24 frames a second. There's one scene that they call it the spider chase scene, that just that one scene took 4 years and like hundreds of animators to do.
Oh my God.
So as an art aficionado, you need to see that movie.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Absolutely amazing. But this idea of, like, even Marvel and the timelines and the Infinity, like, I think we're prepped to be open to whatever weirdness is the phenomena. If it turns out to be dimensions and timelines, great. I think we can accept that. If it turns out to be aliens, great. I think we can accept that as a whole.
Yeah.
I think we've been prepped. And I think the reason these ideas, and then you have the yoga spiritual side, it might all be the same phenomena. And it's people getting at the same thing from different angles and using different words.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope good things come of that. I can't imagine not caring about aliens. That just blows my mind.
It blows my mind, yeah.
And people don't care. That's so fucking cool. I keep hearing about the Spider-Verse movie, and I loved the first one. I thought the first one, the animation was incredible. So
this one's hearing good things. Times 10. I mean, it's badass.
I wonder if we're in a golden age of entertainment right now. The past couple years since the pandemic, we've had some shit games and some really even worse movies and TV shows, and just they spammed so much stuff during the pandemic. I wonder, we've had so many good game releases, fingers crossed that, like, movies are back, video games are back, and we're in this, like, new golden age of good releases, and we're done with that bullshit. Maybe one or two more flops are okay, but I'm optimistic about where things are going. Entertainment wise, at least. I can't say for the rest of the country or politics or whatever.
Politically, I'm not super optimistic, but like that trend, like you said, with Tears of the Kingdom, again, the hype around Final Fantasy 16, and they put out, like, we've been polishing this game for almost 2 years, a year and a half. Like, this,
that's amazing.
And then they said there's no DLC planned. It's a complete game, start to finish. at launch. Wow. This is what you get. And I think
that's they
understand that's what the market wants. We're done being milked with shitty titles, patched, paying for a bunch of DLC. Like we're over it. We're fed up.
Diablo Immortal was a good example of microtransactions and how horrid they are for gaming. And the pay-to-play concept is just insane.
Is there anything else you want to talk about with the Book of Olith?
After the launch, I'll do like a series of interview videos of how the like behind the scenes of how the book was made. All I have to say left is just support your fellow artists. Even if it's not my book, dude, I don't care. Support Cade's music project. Support your friends doing pottery. Support the little farmer's market down the street who's making jelly for $3 and is barely turning a profit. Like, support crafts. Support people. Stop buying corporate shit and stop supporting AAA titles and don't pay for pre-launches anymore. Fuck the fucking these pre-launch crazy deluxe prices that give you an extra mount and a few skins and just like, what? Just stop. Support your local people and listen to good music. Listen to more metal.
Amen. The gaming gods concur. The true messenger of the gaming gods, Chase Henson. Thank you very much.
Thanks, man.
Hey, man, enjoy the show. Bye-bye.
Awesome. See you guys.